I haven't had a drink for 16 years, Gary.
You must be thirsty then. But we can go back, see the guys, chew the fat, and it'll be just like it always was. Except this time, we are going to finish this thing once and for all.
You have a very selective memory, Gary.
Thanks.
Yours, mine, theirs.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs, the world's fourth greatest movie podcast. I'm Roy, and I may or may not wait until I'm the last man on Earth before I start wearing nightgowns.
Hi, I'm John, and if the world doesn't end by the end of this podcast, don't worry, I still have a bomb strapped to my chest.
I'm Phil, and I did not think of something to say here, and I'm worried that anything I do come up with off the cuff will be in poor taste, given the subject matter of at least one of these films, specifically the one that these guys left me to reference in my intro, so I'm not going to take the bait.
That's fine. That's
kaboom!
Fine. We said let's...
Well, I will just say, hello, mates.
Hey.
Welcome.
It doesn't
hello
matter
from the UK.
Say,
given
it
the...
doesn't matter what you say, because everything you say sounds so bloody
cool.
Brilliant the way we hear it. Oh. It's just so great to hear your voice. I've been hearing Utah like voices just like for my whole life, and especially in the last year, mostly just everyone I associate with or just the people I directly work with. So
yeah, we sound pretty stupid.
Hear your, you know, gallant voice from across the ocean.
Well, thank you.
Plenty.
Yeah,
and
we.
Sorry for starting so soon because we forgot to tell you. Hey, think of something clever.
You must be delighted then that I gave you such a lovely variety of British accents in the movie selections we're
yeah.
about to talk about.
Hey, I didn't need subtitles, so I was a little relieved.
Good
yeah, that was good. Yeah. When we last podcasted with you, what did we do? It's been about a year, right? About a full year?
It was, yeah, I think it was middle of September or something last year, yeah.
Do you remember what movies we covered with you?
We did Conan. We did Willow.
And Ator?
Most memorably, we did Ator, Flying Eagle.
Yeah, it's... Oh, this eagle doesn't fly, no. No. This is a fighting eagle.
Yeah.
That's the one we watched, so that was good. It was,
all right.
Yeah, perfect. Sword and Sorcery. So, have you caught up with the whole Ator franchise?
Oh.
No, I'm still... No. Okay. Is there really a franchise, or is that an hilarious joke?
No.
There's two? Are there three? I know there's at least two, and the second one involves time travel. So, you know, that's good. Now, I remember what I was going to say. So Phil, you had your intro, which was a non-intro. Have you either of you guys seen Free Guy yet?
No, but I'm intrigued.
Okay, so Free Guy, like there's a character in it whose catchphrase is catchphrase, right? And Taika Waititi says, saying catchphrase for your catchphrase is actually kind of cool. But anyway, slightly reminded. Anyway, we may be going to the movie theater, the three of us, not together, but in the next week or so. For our follow-up podcast, but we'll talk about that later.
Ah, have either of you been to the movies yet?
So, Phil, I almost never stopped. So, I mean, our movie theaters closed for a few months, but then they opened up, and I found that no one was going except for me. And so I would go to the movie theater, and I'd be completely alone, and they were doing a lot of classic films for a while. So, like, my wife and I saw Ghostbusters again. We saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. We saw The Empire Strikes Back. And then, so like
an empty cinema, just the two of you. That sounds
yeah,
idyllic.
So, I got like a movie pass, right, for one of the theaters here, and I was going like a couple times a week, and again, like hardly anyone. And so I will say, recently I saw The Jungle Book, and maybe about a third of the theater was full, but that's it. And then so Free Guy, it was just me and my two kids at Free Guy on opening day, which was kind of crazy. But yeah, I never stopped going to the movies. I've had a good time.
That's the best reason to go because no one goes.
Yeah,
and I went like during the midst of it all, kind of toward the beginning of like shutdown and everything. I went a couple times because one of my friends rented out a theater. It's like it's safe, you know. I rented it out. I feel like that was way more irresponsible than just going to a random theater because it was probably more full because he rented it out and invited his friends. So at least I knew, like, if I got sick, at least I knew who, like, everyone to blame
yeah.
for that.
So I will say, me and my brothers, we got together in Utah, and one of my brothers rented a movie theater, and we watched Cobra in a movie theater, and that was highly entertaining. That was a lot of fun.
I love that story.
And it was only us. So we'd like, you know how sometimes in movie theater you might whisper to the person next to you? We were like just normal volume, just talking to each other throughout the whole film.
Oh, I'd still whisper. I couldn't possibly do that.
It was a little discordant at first, but anyway, it worked out. So we sometimes talk about new movies. The only new movie besides Free Guy is I'm trying to get through Andrei Rublev, which is a 3-hour Russian film about a guy who paints pre-Renaissance icons at churches. And it's every bit as exciting as it sounds. Been working on that movie for about a week now.
You're the most cultured person I know.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Is that a Tarkovsky?
I don't know, but Phil, I got a hold of a BBC list of the 100 greatest foreign films, and I've been kind of working on them, and this one is just killing me.
That was on it.
Yeah.
They're trolling you.
Yeah.
Right. I believe Andrei Rublev is made by the same guy who made Solaris, I think.
Really?
I think.
I can see that.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's a bummer. I haven't watched anything. I watched The Big Chill last night. I'd never seen that. I quite enjoyed that.
Who's in The Big Chill?
Part of my other movie club. You know, it's got Tom Berenger and Kevin Kline in it. It's just about a bunch of kind of 30-something boomers just on their weekend, you know?
Yeah.
And they're just having a weekend and they're catching up. And they were best friends in college, but they kind of drifted apart. And should they have stayed drifted apart? You know, you kind of wonder if, like, okay, they're deep, huge, massive friendship that they had, you know, was it all just superficial all along kind of thing? That's kind of what I got out of it anyway. That was all right.
Cool.
Did I see anything else? I'm sure I've seen it, but I haven't been. The last time I was in the theater, I feel like it was kind of pre-Delta days when we were just kind of going back again, but I went to see the Sparks movie. Edgar Wright directed. Sparks documentary, which was very Edgar Wright-y, but also exhaustive. Like, he went through every single Sparks album, and there are like 30 albums. Mm. It's like, like, oh my gosh, I did not know that Sparks has just been, you know, for the past 50 years, they've just been churning out just constant music. And, you know, music that all these other musicians like and everything. So it was very eye-opening and really fun. Huh. So I recommend that. I'm sure it's going to be streaming in like a month or so because it's like a perfect one to just sit at home and watch.
So what you're skipping, John, is both of us have now seen the new Suicide Squad. And I loved it John did not because John doesn't like James Gunn.
No, I don't like him. I don't like him. I met him once. And you know, he shoved me, and then I shoved him. Actually, I don't know what he looks like. I don't know what he looks like, but it's like I just don't like the way he just says, okay, I'm joking now. We're joking. This is a big jokey joke thing. Joke, laugh, everybody, laugh, or I'll shoot you, kind of thing. That's just kind of what it feels like watching one of his movies. To me.
That's funny.
I hate laughing, so whatever.
That's true. So like, when you watch The Three Amigos, it's just torture. It's hard.
Fine. You know what? If I'm going to commit to this, I've been lying about Three Amigos and my love for Three Amigos. I hate Three Amigos.
Hey, have you seen the Suicide Squad, Phil?
No. I think they should just stop making DC films. Nobody likes them. DC fans don't like them.
Yeah.
The average cinema goer doesn't seem to like them. I know nothing about DC, but
Suicide Squad's a big 180 from, you know, the
So
DC.
To be honest, like the original the Suicide Squad movie they made a few years ago, it was all right, and I actually liked the Harley Quinn movie, but this one was just crazy and everyone gets killed and the main villain is just this neon giant starfish, like a 500-foot tall neon starfish, which is kind of crazy. But anyway, if you liked Guardians of the Galaxy, then you'll like this movie. If you didn't, then, you know, don't bother.
That villain should have been vindicated, by the way.
Oh, but the original villain was going to be Superman, by the way.
Oh, that would have been cool. Oh, man, I would have liked that. Phil, did you like Guardians of the Galaxy?
I did like Guardians of the Galaxy. It wasn't my favorite of the Marvel films, but it was perfectly fine. I just think the definition of fan in the 20th century is someone who hates something. We've gone a complete 180, and I keep thinking I've found the bottom. like Star Trek fans all hate Star Trek. Star Wars fans absolutely detest everything about Star Wars.
Yeah,
and
no, that's
Doctor
true.
Who fans, my God, they like nothing about Star Wars. They Doctor Who even, they absolutely complain and loathe every bit of it. But possibly DC fans might have taken the crown on that, because I've just never heard anyone who likes DC say anything nice about any of the DC films ever at all.
Oh, so yeah, it's weird because DC had a string of like some serious successes, like the last Christopher Nolan Batman series was really good, right? And then
that's the big exception. Yeah, I'm talking rubbish. Yeah,
well, no, not completely right. But then I'm a huge fan of like 1989 Batman with Michael Keaton, but then that one went downhill real fast. And then I'm also a huge fan of just the early 80s Superman movies when it's still fun, right? When it
I guess I'm thinking of the recent ones. You know,
it's been a disaster.
Well, Wonder Woman was well received. Wonder Woman 1984 was not, and the original Suicide Squad was not, and it sounds like this one was not. And
so critics loved the new Suicide Squad. I think it's in on the Rotten Tomatoes. It's in the 90s, isn't it? But I
think it's up there.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like Wonder Woman, we've talked about it before. I thought the original one was really good, and the second one was a dumpster fire, but it was a really brave dumpster fire. Mm. Anyway,
a brave
put
dumpster
it on the poster.
Yeah, Wonder Woman 1984, the bravest dumpster fire.
It's okay. Sorry, Phil. You got me thinking about, because you're right. I wonder if we have so much content these days that I wonder if like turning on the content we love is the only thing we can do. Like it's the only way we can manage it, maybe. You know, Roy and I mean, you've probably heard us kind of bagging on Star Trek lately, you know, like late Star Trek. We've been bagging on it, and maybe that's not us so much as it's a symptom of what's going on in society. Maybe we're just becoming, you know, like all these other fans that you're mentioning. I assume you're still with Doctor Who, right?
Yeah, I'm still with Doctor Who, and obviously that's there's been an acceleration in the Doctor Who fan dynamics. Now we've had a female Doctor for a few years.
Is that not going well?
I love that actress. She's a great actress.
If you pay your money, it takes your choice. And there's a lot of people who insist furiously that it's not that she's a woman, it's that the scripts aren't any good, and it's that this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, maybe it is because she's a woman. I think you protest too much. And you know, am I giving it an easy ride because it's a woman? I'm, you know, lefty, liberal, right on, feminist, woke, snowflake, etc. Maybe, but I don't think so. I think it is good. I think it's been good for the show. I'm still with it. I think it's just, I see the same thing in music, which is fans of any band, they it's an amazing coincidence that the fans of every band think that the high watermark of their artistic output just happens to be the one that they first discovered.
Oh, well, anchoring bias, right?
And so the longer something goes on, like Star Wars and Star Trek and Doctor Who, which are now, you know, decades long franchises, the more there is to not match up to your first blush of love with that thing.
So for the record, I will say that John and I both really loved The Last Jedi. We thought The Last Jedi was an excellent film.
Yeah,
but a lot of people really hated it.
Ones, pretty much.
Yeah,
the new ones.
Is objective as I can be, and I got to admit, most of my objectivity is being spiteful of all the people who I tend to disagree with in attitude. So this doesn't count at all. But The Last Jedi is probably the best Star Wars movie since 1980. But like thinking about it, I feel like maybe I just go around saying that to be proud of saying that. There's kind of no way to get out of, you know, okay, you know, like there's your opinion and how your opinion is perceived and how your opinion like marks you as a person. And I feel like by saying that, I feel like I'm an incredibly cool person for saying that.
It's possible. If you're going to have a performative opinion, mm-hmm. then it might as well be a positive one rather than a negative one.
Yeah. That's a good way to think about it.
Yeah.
I also wanted to bring up Doctor Who again, Phil, because just you know, in case you're running out of stuff to listen to, there's a podcast I like called Trekking Through Time and Space that I'm like, oh, Phil would love this, and I meant to tell you about this, but it's two people, it's a guy and a girl, and he's watching Doctor Who for the first time, and she's watching Star Trek for the first time, and they're going episode by episode.
Oh my goodness, yes, that sounds right up my.
out of all the people who love podcasts about people watching things for the first time, like, oh, Phil, you gotta
I love
yeah.
podcasts about people who watch things for the first time. I love podcasts about Trek, and I love podcasts about Doctor Who, so triple threat.
Well, there you go, yeah. Now, they're not starting back at, like, the original Doctor Who. Is she starting back at the modern era?
Yeah, they're doing it weird. They're starting at the original series of Star Trek and the modern era of Doctor Who, so the Eccleston Doctor Who.
Got it.
And so that's how they're starting. And so I'm guessing once they finish the modern Doctor Who, and they're talking Torchwood, too, which is interesting. Once they finish that, then I guess they go back. But by the way, Phil, Torchwood, that first season of Torchwood, I watched that because I was listening to the podcast. And that's a rough first season, man.
I don't mind it as much as everybody else in the universe does.
actually, the first four episodes sucked, but the second half of the first season was way, way, way better.
Yeah, so. There's some good ones. Like with the time-traveling soldier guy. Is that the first season?
I think that's, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Guy with from the past who comes to the time warp. And, yeah.
Yeah, the Harkness, the guy whose name he takes, right? Yeah.
Yeah. That's Have you seen the third season yet?
No.
If that is completely different, okay. I would highly recommend watching the third
We can season. Wait.
A drastic, you should go and watch it now. It was scheduled over 1 week on the BBC. It was 5 episodes, 1 episode per night.
Oh, wow.
And it is a dramatic shift in tone, shall we say, from certainly the tone of Doctor Who and certainly the first two series of Torchwood. It's pretty extraordinary. It's really good sci-fi, and it is a challenging watch. So that's the one that everyone talks about. With Torchwood season 3, Children of Earth is the subtitle of that season. I would highly recommend it to anyone.
I look forward to it. Okay, now I'll check it out. I have to finish up the Tenet Doctor Who, and then I switch back to season 2 of Torchwood, and then I think, yeah, I'm watching in order. It's taking a while because I'm pretty much getting like an episode a week, so it's gonna. Take
Imagine watching an episode a week of something.
Jeez.
speaking of, okay, before I forget, I know we're taking up way too much time. Yeah, on and on and on. But I don't think I asked you last time if you'd finished your podcast about Babylon 5.
No, I haven't. Can we, do you want a bit of real talk for a sec?
Oh, let's get real.
Mike, because I feel like you almost finished.
Yeah. So the last time I came on this podcast, you may remember, listeners probably don't, but you guys do, that it was a really difficult time for me for various reasons. It was difficult for everybody, but there was other things going on in my own life. And it was not long after that things got even worse, and I had to, you know, reach out for a bit of help from people, and found out I was depressed and got some help for it, and now I'm doing much better. But one of the sort of casualties of that time was finishing the Babylon 5 podcast. Sure. I just had 2 episodes left. I think maybe 2 or possibly 3. And, you know, not that it was a particularly terrible or horrible or onerous thing in my life, but for some reason just it went on for quite a while where I just didn't feel up to doing anything much. And then when I started to feel a bit better, a lot of time had passed, so I will finish it. It's been a year pretty much since then, but I fully intend to finish it. But it was just one of those things that I had to do, at the time was to jettison some stuff, and that was one of the things I jettisoned. But everything was good, and my message is to people, ask for help.
Talk
to your doctor, talk to support services. Medication is good if that works for you. Therapy is good if that works for you. I've had them both, and they've both been beneficial. I'm sorry, that's not very amusing, but a bit of real talk about what.
No, that's excellent.
It's so annoying that it was two episodes to go. But I promise I will finish it.
Okay, no. And yeah, sorry to put the pressure on. But and thanks for the real talk, though. I'm really glad that you're so open with that. And I think I get it, because I think I kind of understand. Seriously, and I totally don't know my mental state, despite. I feel like, I go to therapy, but I haven't gone, processed, diagnosed anything at all. But what you said rang so true to the periods in my life where, you just have to let go of something. Like that's the only thing you can do. And it's like, okay, the only way I can get through the day is if I cancel plans and I stop this thing from happening. So I totally get it. And I don't understand it for myself, and I certainly don't understand it for you, but that totally makes sense.
And it was funny, if that was one of the things that the therapy I had, which is CBT, made me really be able to do more and to feel okay about, which is to not to just kind of cop out of things and give up on things, but to look after yourself and to just think, it's okay. Like, what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah.
If you don't put an episode of your podcast out, maybe three people are disappointed. They'll be disappointed for 5 minutes, and then they'll go on with the rest of the day and the rest of their lives, and they won't be upset. To look
forward to. Yeah. So you have double our listenership then. So good for you. But so for those of you at home, CBT is cognitive based therapy.
Behavioral therapy.
Behavioral, very good. Oh, very good. So what I'm also hearing from you, Phil, is that coming on our podcast a year ago made things worse.
I'm just thinking about that before we start. And, you can see it as either my rock bottom that immediately precipitated my cry for help, or you can see it as the thing that just kept me going and kept my head above water. And I'll prefer to see it as the latter.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Yeah. Yes, very kind. Thank you. When we're not recording, you can tell us the real story there.
No, that's true, because that was really nice, actually. It was a low time, and it was an absolute treat to chat with you, as it is again.
Okay, yeah, well, that's why we do this. I mean, it's like, it's funny. Anybody listening to now, that's like kind of the side effect.
Both of you?
Yeah, it's the side effect of what we do, but I think the reason we've done this for so long is because it's order for us is what it is.
Yeah.
And if anybody's listening, it's like, okay, as much as you enjoy listening to our wacky conversations, it's nothing compared to being in our conversations.
Yeah.
It's like nothing, it's like, oh, you're only getting 10% of the fun, really.
No,
we're the ones enjoying ourselves.
So I think we've talked about this before, and whatever our listenership is, it doesn't really even matter, because we've had like the emails where it says, we've seen your podcast, we can help you like commercialize it, and we're not interested, because if only one person's listening, we don't really care. And I'm like, this podcast means the world to me, and I love it, and I love looking forward to it, and if it helps someone else, or Phil, if we were able to make you smile for somewhere between 2 and 5 hours, I don't know how long our podcast with you was, but then then that's good.
Now, between those two,
the good news is we've got three movies here that are all really funny, lighthearted, like nothing serious. So, and Phil picked all of them. The theme is Phil picked them. So
maybe says a lot about my mental state. We've just been talking about my mental health, and I'm aware
Phil picked them, and bleakness.
And bleakness.
Yeah. But also hilarity.
Yeah.
That's my life. Bleakness and hilarity.
There
the
you
British
go.
Way.
Yes. Very, very. Okay, so how are we gonna do these?
John, you're up. You are talking about Quiet Earth, and which, by the way, when I posted my comments on the Quiet Earth, I don't know if you saw on Facebook, but it immediately received a visit the COVID-19 Information Center for vaccine resources.
Really? Tag.
Yeah, because I said, what was my thing? I said, this is what the Earth's going to look like in 2 years if you don't get vaccinated. Seriously, go get vaccinated. And so I got that. And then this round, did I get banned this round? I probably got banned this round too, for saying the word kill in one of my comments. So I have to stop saying the K word.
It's, yeah, no, it's, yeah, Roy's on super thin ice.
Yeah, well, our page.
Yeah.
My fault, but our page is on thin ice. I have to stop being so violent in my comments.
We might lose our podcast page because, well.
But I'm bloodthirsty.
It's a long story. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I think I saw him on January the 6th, I've got to say. I think he's just a trouble causer. Always said this about Roy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I thought
violent extremist.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's well, it's like two dates. It's like January 6th and whatever day we watch Dream a Little Dream 2.
Yeah.
The most violent.
It's not my fault.
Yeah. Most violent days in 2021.
Yeah. Anyway. But, John, so I think you're up, and I'm glad because you get to talk to us about New Zealand's Carl Weathers.
Yeah. No, this is great. Okay, so The Quiet Earth is a movie, and like I said last time, I had never heard of this movie, I don't think, and it's a New Zealand movie, and it was out, like, you know, 10 years before I was in New Zealand, and I was in New Zealand for a couple years, but anyway, it's New Zealand, and it's about a guy who wakes up, he's a nude man, and he's depressed that he, you know, he's a nude man in a clothed man's world, and so he was depressed, but he wakes up, and he's like, oh, well, I guess I can... you know, there are good things about being the only person left alive. He's the only person alive. So he goes around looting. Hopefully he saves the ice cream. Fortunately, the electricity still works. Everything still works. Yeah. You know, the infrastructure is still in place. There are just no people. There are no animals. There is just nothing. Yeah, no living animals. Plants are still alive, but humans and animals are gone, except for the birds in the opening credits. Which weren't supposed to be there. They were supposed to get this great shot of the sun in the opening credits, and some birds majestically flew by, and they're like, oh crap, those birds aren't supposed to be there. Normally that would be an awesome shot, but those birds are just, they're not supposed to be there. Okay, so anyway, so he's just going around. After about 5 hours, he kind of goes super crazy. He starts, you know, speaking to cardboard cutouts. He, you know, he's wearing a slip negligee. He starts, you know, talking about being president of everything. But that is when a lady with a gun shows up, and they hug. And so they're the last two people alive. It's like a real last man on earth situation. And he says, finally, in dialogue, it's like, okay, I was working on this big project. It was a Project Flashlight, and it was an American idea. He makes that very clear. The Americans, they wanted to suck everybody away or, you know, profit unnecessarily. And I was thinking about this, Phil. It's Project Flashlights. Do you have flashlights in Britain, or do you have torches?
We have torches.
Okay. Yeah, because that's what they are in New Zealand, too. So, like, the project, I think that was a thing. Like, the project name is a very American name. Because in New Zealand, it would be a torch. So it wouldn't be called Project Flashlight in New Zealand. So I think that was kind of a very American way of saying, yes, this is an American idea.
So did you notice, like, when he meets the girl, right? The first thing they'd go do is find a cheap motel. Like, he'd been living in, like, this gorgeous mansion.
I did not notice that, but that's very
fitting.
It adds
a frisson sometimes, doesn't it?
It's with the role play, you know, there's something about the dirtiness of finding a cheap motel, specifically one with a waterbed. I was watching The Quiet Earth, you know, when they go to the motel, when they walk into the motel. I didn't notice this the first time I watched it, but I was, like, watching scenes earlier today, and it was actually pointed out to me because I was listening to the Neil deGrasse Tyson commentary, hoping for some insight into the movie. They mentioned, hey, did you notice that, you know, on the floor of the hotel that they go into, it was one that had previously been used. There were clothes on the floor. I noticed the bra, but what I didn't notice was the priest's collar also on the floor. So it was a priest and some kind of, you know, some woman with a pink bra going into this hotel room together. But then they were raptured, so I guess everything is okay. But we'll get to that. Okay, so anyway, he's like, okay, so I think this is going to happen again. We got to prepare. They have this idyllic life, but then, what do you know? There's another guy who comes along.
New Zealand Carl Weathers.
Yeah, that's New Zealand Carl Weathers. He's a Maori fella, and so the three of them, they're together. You know, despite pulling guns on each other when they first meet, they form, you know, a family of sorts. But, you know, I mean, watching this as a man, thinking, okay, last man on Earth, and there's a beautiful woman, but then this other guy comes along. This is where you feel the tension, right? I mean, I feel like they were relatively civilized, but, you know, there's this tension. Yeah. And she kind of says, you know, pretty much, you know, she pulls the Lane Myers on him. You know, I think it would be in my best interest if I went out with someone more popular.
If I dated New Zealand Carl Weathers instead.
You know, it's like, I mean, she pretty much says to, you know, the main scientist guy, it's like, well, I mean, you understand he's a man, right? He's a man. Like, he's a real man.
Yeah. You're a bald scientist nerd who wears sensible sweaters.
Yeah.
And this guy drives massive trucks in an irresponsible fashion.
Right, right. This guy rams trucks through other trucks.
Yeah. It was like, it doesn't get more manly than
that. Wages of Fear moment there, right? Like, yeah. It was pretty, but so, yeah, I mean, so basically he was fine when he was the only man alive because, you know, beggars can't be choosers, but as soon as there was any choice, there was anyone not what's his name, Zach? Anyone not Zach comes along, right?
Right.
So, but you notice that they are also now like, they're like sleeping on mattresses on the floor. I mean, every single house is available. Every house with bedrooms are available, and they're just on these dirty mattresses on the ground somewhere.
So, I did not notice that. I think
they're not last man on earthing very well.
Right, they're not. But I guess I kind of get it. It's almost like, I mean, because he was finding the most elaborate house he could. But then when he found her, you know, they're just like, okay, whatever. I think the point was, you know, the people you find are way more important than the place you live.
Well, like, there you go.
You know, they didn't care so much about, you know, opulence because they had each other and that was more important. So yeah. I guess that's kind of what that's saying.
And it's also saying, because it was when he was in the mansion that he went kind of gaga. Yeah. So what they're saying is living in luxury on your own sends you completely blah, 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 off the deep end.
So this movie is similar to Omega Man, right? And Omega Man, I think, predates it. But
this movie ripped off Omega Man. Go ahead, Sam.
So one of the fascinating theories about Omega Man is like he lives in the town where he's every night he's attacked by the mutants, right? Mm-hmm. And he's going crazy, but it's better to live near your enemy than to be alone. And like, and so like, once he finds the girl in Omega Man, then they're off to the mountains, right? So like, it and I'm a pretty strong introvert, and I think I could last a while by myself. But I think eventually you're going to go batty, right? But so the good news for what's the girl's name?
Joanne.
Joanne. Mm-hmm. So she now has two men to choose from. It's not really a choice because only one of them has leather pants.
Mm-hmm. and an earring.
Yeah, and an earring. And an earring. So they're in pretty good shape. So this movie's fascinating because I went through several theories before I landed on the last one as to what's going on. But I'll stop interrupting, John.
The scientist is like, okay, well, they figure out a plan to like blow up the building where the glitches are happening. And he steals the truck, you know, before he can get the radio control unit. He's like, okay, well, you know what? She prefers him anyway, so I may as well just go do this on my own. And he blows it up right as, if I understand right, right as they, right at the height of their sexual activity, he blows up the place. There's a big bang, and then they wake up, but then he wakes up. Here's the big thing. And I'm glad you have a theory about this because I watched the whole commentary just now waiting to hear Neil deGrasse Tyson's tell me what happened. And he's like, oh, isn't the end beautiful? This is Saturn. And that's all he said. He's like, Saturn's my favorite planet.
Well, I'm glad he gave that insight. So these people, they all the one thing they all have in common is this Operation Flashlight created some sort of event, right? Mm-hmm. And but they all died at the moment of the event the first time. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they all have in common. And then the event happens again when he dies, right? I don't know what happens to the other two, but he dies, and then he ends up and he's watching Saturn rise, right? I have my theory, but what's yours? What do you guys think? What's going on?
I think the event spread everyone out into the universe. He's just experiencing what everybody in the first event experienced, which is kind of what he was going through before. Because I feel like he's alone on this new world, and the event just spread all living things out, like a big bang of life. It just transported everybody else somewhere else. And he's just on one of 5 billion other planets.
So I don't know if you've done
nothing to base that on, really.
Do you have any thoughts, Phil? I don't know if you've done any research or if you've just watched it enough time that you have some idea what you think is going on.
I agree. I think the director has said, "Oh, we thought it was pretty obvious. He's just like been sent to another universe." So I suppose what I think is that the first event, I think at one point Zach says something about, it's like we've been shifted sideways in time or something. Mm-hmm. So I think like the first event sends him to sort of this world that is like our world, but if everyone disappeared. And then he talks about how some of the universal constants are changing, and it's getting, the amplitude is getting wider, so things are getting more chaotic. So the second event then has a more dramatic effect and sends him to a completely different world. I think that's what we're supposed to take from it. It reminded me a bit of, have you ever seen The Langoliers?
No, I've heard of it.
That a novella, so cool. Stephen King novella.
People disappear on the plane. I know Balky from Perfect Strangers, I believe, is in the TV movie.
And Dean Stockwell hamming it up as well, marvelously. And it's so the TV movie, like all Stephen King adaptations, pretty much lets it down. Mm. But it's got a nice atmosphere where, everybody dies, but they've just, well, they think everyone's died, but what's happened is they've just kind of been stuck 5 seconds in the past. So, like, the physical world is still there, but the rest of the living world has moved on. And then the Langoliers, these things that sort of tidy up after history, and they come and devour the now dead world of the past.
So, in The Quiet Earth, is everybody still on Earth, but they're just shifted away from the three people who died?
I think yes, I think they are in a different world, and we've branched into another world where they disappeared, and all the planes crashed, and all the cars crashed, and what have you.
Mm.
But because that was the first event, that's like a little shift. And then, as he says, these universal constants continue to go out of whack. And so in the second event, he goes to somewhere completely different, I think. Or possibly what it's telling us is that if there's only you and two other people on Earth, and they are a loved up new couple, and one of them's your ex, then suddenly driving a truck full of explosives into a radioactive wasteland doesn't sound so bad.
Mm-hmm. Jeller Knights.
Death has considerably lost its sting in that scenario.
That's how far away you need to get from that situation. You need to blow yourself that far across the universe in order to receive the comfort of distance. And is that Neil deGrasse Tyson said that was Saturn. But I don't know if he was just saying that because it looks like Saturn, or
I think it's just a random planet.
Okay,
hey, it's some random alternate universe.
Because you can't breathe. I mean, I assume you can't breathe on any of Saturn's moons. Because I mean, it wouldn't be. He wouldn't be on Saturn. No. He'd be on a Saturn's moon, and you can't breathe on
Indeed.
Saturn's moon, right? So,
no.
Okay. So yeah, it's probably it's some.
He's just one of those people who has to crush everyone else's fun by being mercilessly realistic at all times.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I have a wildly different theory.
Oh, good.
I think he's dead, and I think the first round was his first round of purgatory. that like so I think he's definitely those kind of an introverted person, right? So so his punishment is he finally gets a girl, and he's probably one of those nerds who never gets a girl, but now he's got one because she has no choice, and then like a man comes along and ruins everything, and that's his punishment. And then the next punishment is he's on a world completely alone. There's no one at all, and this is just the second cycle of his purgatory.
So the end of the world like didn't really happen. Like this whole Project Flashlight, like
it may or may not have. Maybe everyone's dead, and this is just his personal purgatory, or maybe he just died and because he had the knowledge of that project, this was what was extrapolated for.
Because if this is the way purgatory works, like these three people died at the same time, so it's their turn to go through purgatory at the same time.
Yeah, or they may simply be part of his purgatory. Maybe they're not real people at all, right? They're just
yeah, they're there to torture him.
Yeah, this
it sort of hints at that, just ever so slightly, once or twice throughout the film, isn't it? He says something about maybe I am the effect, maybe I'm dead, but then shrugs it off and says, "Oh, but the truck is the best chance we've got, so let's go with it." And it's just kind of brushed under the carpet. So I said I agreed with John and that it's an alternate universe, but I also agree with Ryan, it's actually purgatory. I don't know what I think. But I think that's why I liked it, because I picked this film because it was, I remember seeing it quite young, I think like 10 or 11 or something, and you know, occasionally we'd be allowed to stay up late to watch something. If something came on that was interesting, my parents kind of got into it, they would just kind of forget to tell us to go to bed. I remember this being on and just thinking, this is just really weird. Because the first 20 minutes of the film, there's barely a word of dialogue, and it's just this weird atmosphere throughout it. And then there's the kind of like Inception-style wall-shifting, gravity-shifting thing towards the end, and you're never quite sure what's going on. And at the end, you've just got this absolutely bizarre left-turn, mysterious scene with no closure, no explanation. And as a young lad, it triggered something in me. I like the fact that it was unapologetically quite weird and just left field and off the wall. That's why I picked it. I liked it because the end is so ambiguous and so out there and so sort of outrageously brash in its, I don't care, I'm not going to give you an ending. I'm just going to give you this final scene. You can make what you like of it.
The end scene.
The bravado.
Yeah, it snuggles right into this weird territory where it's just so obviously like you have no idea what's happening, but it's also so close. It's so close to like you knowing something, but definitely not knowing something, but far away from they just put something up that I don't care about. It's just like right in that weird sweet spot where like I know I can't figure this out, but the feeling is real, and so I'm gonna feel real about it.
It doesn't a more modern version of this film might sort of over egg the ending in a sort of confrontational way to be performatively obscure. Hey, you didn't see that coming, did you? Hey, look at that. Aren't we clever? This felt more like it was just saying, and then he woke up on another planet. What do you think of that? We don't know. Don't ask us. But isn't it fun? It felt more inclusive rather than just being knowingly, deliberately obscure for the street cred. It was just a nice, fantastical, odd ending.
So one of my favorite movies of all time is Blade Runner, and I love the ambiguity of the ending. And then Ridley Scott kind of ruined it. Like, he gave an interview where he said, yeah, he's an android, right? And just kind of like stole the ambiguity away from the end of that film. And so I do like the ending where we can sit here and speculate and no one knows. So wherever he is or whatever state he's in, that's a pretty cool Saturn rise, I guess, right? And the clouds look super cool. And so I'm assuming this is like, because this is early 80s, that's got to be just like animated? It's got to be animated, right?
Yeah, or some matte painting, I guess.
I mean,
I think it's because Saturn. I feel like there are two plates. I think just a painted Saturn in the back, and those clouds are ever so slightly animated, right? because it looks like the clouds are like rooting into the ground. They're like half clouds, half trees, and you're thinking those clouds aren't acting like our clouds. Like I feel it almost looks like the clouds are descending to the ground, rather than raining, they're descending and inserting like some kind of proboscis thing into the ground and sucking the ground rather than the other way around, you know. It's like you can just tell those are alien things.
Sort of cloud city or something. Mm-hmm. Is there something up there living in those tall pillars of cloud? Is there something living on the ringed planet? This is going to sound really wanky, but I like the fact that it seems to sort of set it up for a sequel. Uh-huh. Like, now he's in this completely different situation. What on Earth is going to happen now? Or what on Saturn is going to happen now? And then doesn't give you an answer, and there's no sequel, there's no follow-up, and no explanation. And it's almost like saying, there you go, now you go and write your own sequel to that. And I think, as I say it, as a youngster, 9 or 10, whatever I was, years old, it's just sort of inviting you to say, look, we've told you a little story, and then we've given you a fantastical ending. Go away and think about your own sequel to this. What happens to this guy now? We don't know. Use your imagination.
It's just a glimpse into the undiscovered country.
Indeed.
Interesting. Okay, well, I'm glad you got to saw it. This would have really blown my mind at 10. And since I'm as jaded as I am, it's a 40-something-year-old, it only blew half my mind. Because I've filled, like, my whole life with you know, cynicism and movie-making whatever, and if I saw this as 10, then, oh boy, I would be raving maniac right now. I wouldn't even know what to say. So I'm glad you survived the Quiet Earth at such a young age.
I'm impressed my parents let me watch such full frontal dong. I might have missed the first 5 minutes, I have to say. I'm not sure I remembered that first time around.
Oh man. So I don't know. So that's another question. If you really think you're the last man on Earth, at what point do you just stop wearing clothes? I don't know. I really like this film, and when I started watching this film, my original thought was, okay, what separates this from any other like 70s, 80s kind of sci-fi movies? And Phil just likes it because, you know, he saw it as a kid and he's got memories. But I did enjoy this movie, and I think it's better than most that try to do something similar of that time period or that genre. So, and again, like with John, I'd never even heard of this film. So, thank you, Phil. This was a good view.
Glad you liked it some degree. I'm not going to say it's, you know, the best film ever, and it's going to be on your list of 100 films to see before you die or whatever, but it's just something a bit different, something that people haven't seen, and it's nicely diverting for an hour and a half, and perfect running time, 97 minutes.
Oh yeah,
that's what we like.
Yeah, good time for the end of the world. Alright, well, it's all downhill from here, I think.
And so that's interesting, because I just made a change to my movie rankings. And maybe I'll change it back. We'll see.
Nothing's set in stone.
You haven't worked it out?
Nothing's set in stone as far as my rankings go. Yeah, I'm still struggling greatly. I'll just say that.
The last thing that occurs to me about The Quiet Earth, I just want to say quickly, is as well as I said a moment ago, it sort of invites you to write your own sequel. It also invites you to write your own story within the first 20 minutes or so, by which I mean I was really pleased that the character for the first part of the film doesn't really talk to himself that much. And I think if they were making it, if it was like a Hollywood version nowadays, either he would be talking to himself all the time, or there'd be some kind of retrospective narration where he'd be sort of saying, and it was then that I realized that everything I knew had gone, everything that ever meant anything to me wasn't there anymore, and I was going to have to look after my... to tell you how he was feeling. But in this film, there's very little soundtrack in that first bit, and very little of him talking to himself, a little bit on the dictaphone and what have you. But we're kind of experiencing it with him and working it out with him, and it was kind of refreshing not to have him say, Is there nobody at this gas station? Where is everybody?
Yeah.
Except he would say in a Kiwi accent, which I can't do.
Yeah. So he wasn't talking to nobody. He did have Mannequin Hitler, mm-hmm. which he I did. Don't know like why Mannequin Hitler was available at some store or wherever he got that from.
Did
okay. I agree with your Facebook comments that he went a little bit crazy, a little bit fast. I'm not saying I wouldn't get to Mannequin Hitler stage, but it might take me more than 5 days.
Let me ask this right now. I watched this movie with a lady friend, and her question was, like, where do you get those cutouts? Tell me if you agree with me on this. Because he had, like, he had a lot of printers at work. He had a really big building, you know, they had nice computers. And, you know, it's 85, but you could probably print out, like, at least black and white things, like on dot matrix.
And those dot matrix printers, I loved that. That took me right back.
Yeah. But, like, I think, like, on an 8x, on an A4 sheet of paper, right, A4, like, he just prints out, like, the face of Marilyn Monroe, and then on another sheet, he prints out her shoulder, and then he just trims around, and then he just pastes them all together on, and then he folds out cardboard box. That's what I think he did. But other than that, do you think... I mean, I guess you guys wouldn't know because you haven't been to New Zealand. Are there a lot of stores that sell cardboard cutouts of people?
Well, there aren't, as far as I know of. And the ones that do exist, they were odd choices, weren't they? The Queen. Oh, I suppose I could see the Queen. If you had a store doing mm-hmm. mannequin cutouts, the Queen. Pope John Paul II, maybe. Bob Marley, maybe. Winston Churchill's getting a little bit strange, and then Hitler. You feel that would be a specialist order. Raise a few eyebrows when you went into the mannequin store.
Yeah.
Have you got a photo of what you want? Yeah. Yeah, it's here you go. What? Are you quite sure, sir?
That's not Hitler, he just looks like him, okay?
Charlie Chaplin, honest.
He looked a lot like Hitler. Okay. Yeah, okay, so anyway, yeah, I guess... Or he could have, if you have the time, I suppose you could just transpose. Like one of my big projects in high school is, you know, when I did my grid painting, where you take a small photographic image, you grid it out, and then you just increase the grid on a bigger piece of paper, and then you just copy what's in the individual boxes. You make sure they're all connected, and you can pretty much get a photorealistic, you know, copy of something that's much larger. And then he could have just pasted it onto. Sorry, I think we're talking about
that. That's how
the
you did your Hitlers.
That's how I. Yeah.
That's like, how John does his Hitlers. Yeah.
Like no one would blow up a copy of Hitler for me, so I had to draw Hitler myself.
It's ironic, guys. I promise.
So it's funny because one of the schools that my kids in, we're looking for schools and we're looking for houses, and one of the schools that we're not going to be sending our kids to is Stonewall Jackson High School, right? Wow. And it just like it's so weird to me that like because I can't imagine that like you're in Germany and you know because you live in Munich or whatever, your kid has to attend Joseph Goebbels High School, right?
So. Right. Well, I mean,
this country's weird.
In Germany, it's illegal, though, right? Like they,
I believe so.
They made it an official. Like, okay, you know what? No more Nazi stuff.
Cut out that, like, Nazi stuff.
Yeah, it's like it's, you know, not like here where we're like, well, you know, we still have the right to free speech. We can do whatever we want, but you know, it's got to be met with. It's still going to be met with public criticism, but I guess there just wasn't enough public criticism for Stonewall Jackson School.
Not enough.
Which is weird.
Okay, so Ford Lions, have you guys seen the movie Profile, which is the slightly more serious movie, sort of similar? Have you seen Profile?
No, I don't know Profile.
Profile's the movie of the true story about the reporter who allows herself to be recruited by a guy from ISIS, right?
Mm.
That's a pretty freaky movie. But anyway,
scary.
Yeah, a little bit, right? Like, and I don't know, like if the movie is more dramatic than the story, but it's a pretty crazy story. That's worth a watch. But what we watched was Four Lions. So I'll just I can sum this up pretty quick, I think. So we have four Muslim chums who live in the UK, and they really want to do jihad. They want to do their part. But like, they're not very good and they're stupid and their ideas are pretty crazy. Like, one of the first things you see them do is they all take the SIM cards out of their phones and they eat them. Right. And I think, I can't remember the name of the one guy that's very white. What's his name? Nigel Lindsay playing Barry, right?
Yeah, Barry, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think Barry, after they swallowed their SIM cards, he basically, I don't know if you've seen the old Scarlet Pimpernel movie, but he like quotes it. So kind of fascinating, but just like saying, like, you know, Muslim here, Muslim there, you can't find them. Anyway, I'm no one cares. But
he is. I mean, maybe Scarlet Pimpernel was his parents' favorite show. I mean, because he is, can't remember if they come out and say it, but he is just a white guy, right? I mean, he's not. I mean, they make fun of him, right, because he doesn't have an uncle in, like, Pakistan, so...
Yeah, so, like, so a couple of them, Oman and Waj, they're going to go to Pakistan to train, right? And and he wants to come along, but they won't let him. And, like, his name is just Barry, right? It's like, it could be Kyle, Steve, it's Barry. And so they won't let him, and they have to stuff him in the back of the car so he won't come. And it's a pretty good moment where he sticks his head out through, like, the armrest, right? but, like, what they, like, Oman says, okay, you can come if you can understand this. And he says something in Arabic, and, of course, he doesn't understand. But Oman and Waj, are they brothers? Omar.
Yeah. Why
am I saying Oman? Is that another movie?
Because if you took physical notes, then you curve the R down to the ground too far.
That's not what I did. No, in the World's End, isn't there a character that they refer to?
Oman.
Yeah. Okay. That's right.
Okay.
So Omar and Waj, they go to Pakistan to train. They suck at it real bad. Waj, by the way, is like, he's the like completely incompetent, has no idea what he's doing. Seems like he'd be pretty fun to hang out with, right? Waj seems like a pretty good guy. They decide at one point to try and take down a drone with a shoulder missile. And he's got it backwards, so he doesn't hit the drone. He hits a camp. And you learn at the very end of the movie that he killed Osama bin Laden. So, you know, they did kill some people, right? It was the wrong people. Anyway, they come back to the UK and they've got their plan. And I think in the meantime, Barry has recruited another, what's the other guy's name?
Hassan,
right? Because Hassan shows up at this like college where Barry is talking, and Hassan stands up and he shows that he's got a bomb belt, right? And then his comment is, you thought it was a real bomb just because I'm Muslim, huh? Right? Like, I thought that was pretty good. But so he's recruited him. So now they've got this gang and they're getting ready to do this thing, right? They get the materials, they train and whatever. And there's a lot of silly moments where there's some seriousness and where it starts getting. So one of the characters I really love is, I love Omar's wife, right? Like, she is the most supportive wife of a would-be suicide bomber that I've ever seen. Like, she's just really supportive, and them and their kids, they water gun fight all the time, and it's great, right? Where things like start going wrong is Faisal, who, man, I love Faisal, right? Faisal is like Waj is stupid, but Faisal's like a little kid. He has there's no maturity, right? He has not like grown up or whatever. And Faisal has got the bomb on his body, and he's running through a field, and he like falls off this wall, and like he blows up. And is that like at the end in the titles where it says one sheep was killed while filming this? Is that true?
Like, I read it like a joke, but those end credits with the animals killed, I feel like you can't joke in those situations, but I guess you can.
I think they wouldn't have put it right at the start of the credits if it was true.
Right.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Faisal kills himself, but they've got this idea to bomb the London Marathon, I guess. Right? Like, one of the things they keep saying when they're going to kill people is, we're going to turn you into baked beans, and I think that's pretty great. I think that's pretty funny, right? They're at the marathon, and then they're not very good at keeping their cool, and it just becomes apparent that there's a situation going on. And like, you have the snipers, and is it Omar that's dressed like a bear? One of the snipers is told to take down the bear, and they kill some guy who's dressed up like Chewbacca. And he said, we've got a bear down. No, that's a Chewie. We have a Chewie down. But it's pretty good. So you have Benedict Cumberbatch, who has a really brief role as the worst negotiator ever. Like, he's really bad. Also,
Pompidou's butler that makes an appearance from the greatest British TV show ever.
This podcast
is
over.
No one saw Pompidou. No one saw
Pompidou. Oh, someone saw Pompidou like each episode five times. And that, I guess I'm the only one.
Who was his butler?
That's, let's see, what's the actor's name? But I saw him, I'm like, that's the Pompidou from... That's the butler from Pompidou. Well, let's see. What's the guy's name? He's the guy who's out. Who's Alex McQueen?
And what does he play in this?
He plays Malcolm Storage, MP.
MP. Let me see.
Oh, what else he's in. He's been in lots. Always doing that kind of role.
Most importantly, he's Pompidou's butler.
Yeah, doing the pompous politician. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got that Benedict Cumberbatch is a he's got a very short role. It's pretty awful. So I mean, so. Basically, what now happens is all these terrorists die, but not the way they want to. None of them have the effect that they want to. Barry dies because he's choking on some food, and someone goes to give him the Heimlich.
Yes.
The other guy that was recruited, I'm just so awful with remembering names. You guys already said
Hassan?
How did Hassan die?
He went to go surrender, didn't
he?
Yeah, he ran right up to the cops.
He gives himself up.
Yeah, and he gave himself up, and then he blew up.
Didn't Barry kill him? He dialed his detonator.
No, you're right. So, like, okay, I'm just going to finish this, and then we'll talk about the problem. So you have Oman, who ends up detonating. He actually does detonate himself near a crowd, right? At the end, or he's around police anyway.
He goes into a chemist,
Okay.
Yeah.
So the saddest is Waj, right? Because Waj is just like as innocent as a baby. By the way, Nandor the Relentless, I don't know, Phil, if you watch What We Do in the Shadows.
No, but I really have to. It's one of those shows I've been meaning to watch for such a long time. I know he's in it, and it's great and everything.
I love that show so much. The movie is slightly better than the show, but the show is still really, really good. Speaking of Kiwi stuff, right?
Yeah, that's Kiwi stuff.
Yeah. So Waj just is like in a kebab shop, right?
Yeah.
And he's telling the kebab owner, it's just him and the kebab owner, and he's like, hey, you know, it's cool. We're going to go to paradise. We're killing the kafar, which I guess is just the non-Muslim people, right?
Yeah.
And the guy like turns him and says, I'm Muslim. There's no kafar here. What are you doing? And his brother calls him. His brother tries to talk him into... surrendering, right? He said, I'm going to turn myself in. Just turn yourself in. And he just does it. He has no idea what he's doing. And like the funny moment is he's like, I'm not confused. Let me take a picture of my face and look at it. Yeah, that's not my confused face. But like the cops come in and they've got him and he just turns to the cops and he says, sorry guys, I don't know what I'm doing, and just blows up, right? And then the show, and I think they shoot the other guy, right?
They shoot the other guy. Kind of looked more Muslim, I guess. And also
Did he say like, hold this. Didn't he give him his bomb to hold?
Yeah, his bomb on the left side of the table. Yeah.
And then the newscast at the end was like the a terrorist blew himself up, I'd have to look up the quote, but like the police like shot someone, but then the other guy blew himself up.
As far as I know, the wrong man was shot.
Yep.
Or the right man was shot, but the wrong man blew up.
Yep.
Which is the classic kind of fudge that these reports end up with to just cover everyone's behind.
So I mean, this movie has a lot that's really funny, and it's gonna pop up in my awards a lot. So but like there's just a couple scenes, like when Barry detonates Hassan, right? Like,
yeah,
that's not really funny. When Waj dies, it's not funny. And also, is there, so I don't know if there should ever be limits to comedy, right? I think I read an article about the right to offend when it came to this movie. But I Googled this movie and I expected to see a lot of articles about like this movie being controversial. And really wasn't. There wasn't a lot, right? Mm. But I feel like this is like just one of those topics that's hard, and there's such a tightrope. And it's like, could you make a comedy TV show about like, you know, people in an abortion clinic who like have to like get rid of dead fetuses, right? Like it would be really hard. And so there's some moments in this movie where they're not supposed to be funny, and it's not. But there's some moments where maybe it is supposed to be funny, and it's just, it's uncomfortable. So, I think this movie is very entertaining. I don't even know how to say this. I'm not sure we should be joking
about terrorists and suicide bombings, and that sounds really kind of stupid, because we ought to be able to laugh at this kind of stuff, but it also I feel like laughing at this stuff or making a joke of it kind of minimizes a little bit how serious it is, and so this film walks that really narrow line.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of stumbles a bit on the wrong side, maybe a couple times. So, I mean, that's kind of how I feel. And so I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was really funny. And there were those scenes where it was really uncomfortable, and there were the scenes where I knew it was supposed to be funny, but it was still uncomfortable. But so, I mean, John, what do you think? I know that you have thoughts about this movie.
Well, okay. I mean, it's funny. It's funny. It's funny that I'm talking right now, and it's funny the movie also. And the thing is, the movie, I think it gets away with a lot, and perhaps justifiably, unjustifiably so. It's so funny. The jokes are so funny. And mm-hmm. I was laughing really, really hard. And I think that provides a lot of leeway that I'm happy to give. And I'm totally cool. I've been thinking about it a lot, and I think one of the things that sort of annoys me is, okay, it is kind of a simplistic take for us to be like, okay, these are just idiots. And one of the problems I have with it is that Riz Ahmed's character is a real person, while the other three are just so buffoonish. And it's like, okay, they're so buffoonish that I think we can stomach them blowing up. But, like, saying that out loud, and right now I just came to this realization, like, that was, like, a problem I had with the movie, like, a few minutes ago. But right this very moment, I'm like, well, I think that's a good thing about the movie, that the movie was brave enough to not just do the buffoonish. Like, three-fourths of them are buffoonish, but they, to have that thread of humanity and make it uncomfortable, too, it's like, I'm like, and it makes me, like, I'm not like my, because I told you last week, Phil, when you called in, and when I said, I'm like, I kind of have some problems with this. It's not like, oh my gosh, this is such an offensive movie. It's never like that, but it's like this. It's me just being like, it's making me gauge my feelings and why I'm feeling that. And for that, I have respect for the movie, even though I'm not sure, but I think it's probably better to be not sure about something than just to be like, oh, you know, they copped out with something, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. So, I have my misgivings, but I think they're respectable misgivings, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Look, I've been thinking about this all day, and I've come up with 101 different things to say, which I won't cover all of them, of course, because we don't have time, and because this is a fun podcast. But I mean, where to start? I think you're absolutely right that you've got it's right to have misgivings about this. I think, and Roy, you said it walks a line. I think that is absolutely the key aspect of this film. The key thing to keep in mind is it's walking a line. I think that is the truth of it, and I think that's what it tries to do and does very successfully. All the time you're thinking, should I be laughing at this? And when we spoke last week, John, I said that I'd watched the first, I think, sort of 20 minutes or so of the film again for the first time in a while, and you expressed some reservations, and I shared them. I'd watched the first 20 minutes, and I was thinking, wow, I feel less comfortable about this than I used to, and I wondered why that was, and there's various reasons for that. But then I watched the rest of it today, and I have to say, by the end, it had won me back over, with the caveat that I'm open to persuasion on this film. I'm still somewhat on the fence. At the end of watching it, I was on its side again, but I'm open to persuasion, and I'm interested to hear opposing views about this film. But I think overall I went with it, and I think it does so many things that I admire. For example, it doesn't give you a magical pixie dream girl Muslim.
Okay.
Right. So most, I mean, the main characters are terrorists, obviously, with various degrees of competence. But the wife of Omar, who we quite like and we think is a nice person, well, at the end of the day, she's harboring a terrorist, and his brother, who is kind of trying to talk some sense into him, still has some views about women that maybe us Western liberals might blanch at. I thought it was a bold choice to not sort of cop out and think, oh, we've got to put in like an ultra liberal gay Muslim or what have you that represents something that will make the Western average person feel comfortable. It never sort of tries to throw you a softball and say, oh, it's okay because we've got this character in here who represents all the woolly liberal ideals of what a Western liberal thinks a Muslim should be. It is just committed to its characters and making fun of them. I think it's committed to its ideas, and I think it largely gets away with them by being funny. And the fact is, you know, I watched a lot of videos from Chris Morris, the director, before this, and I think he sums it up well when he says, he's asked, were you worried about a fatwa? Were you worried about reprisals? And he says, well, not really, because it's not about Islam. And nowhere does the film criticize Islam, and that is absolutely true. It's just a spoof on idiots. And he says, you'll get idiots everywhere. Everywhere men are together, it's like a stag party vibe that they've got. You know, there's a group of guys together kind of egging each other on. And what you'll get, whether it's in a stag night or a terrorist cell, you will get a bond, but you won't necessarily get anything productive or practical out of a bunch of guys. And it's just...
One relieving
guys are
thing...
stupid. People are stupid.
Yeah,
well, people are idiots. Because terrorists are people, they're stupid too, and they do dumb things. And why should anything be off limits in that sense? Everyone can be stupid. Everything can be a source for humor.
All the white people are not smart.
Are very dim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like everybody, I mean, because you got Cumberbatch, which is like, I think he was like trying to get by as a negotiator on his serious Cumberbatch face. I guess that's what he depended on. And, you know, the snipers who don't know the difference between a bear and a Wookiee. And then Riz Ahmed's like coworker boss person who like runs in circles because like his left leg wants it more than his right leg. but I think that helps with whatever weird tone they're going for. But also, I think the most interesting serious part of this, and I guess maybe the most eye-opening thing for Westerners watching this, is Riz Ahmed is the cool guy. Like, he's the coolest one. And he's kind of the most liberal one. And, if you saw him on the street, like, he would be your, you know, cool Muslim friend at work. And his weird brother, you know, the conservative one, like, that's who you would think would be the suicide bomber. You know, the person who says, you know, women shouldn't be talking and da-da-da-da and all of this. And, you know, to see him, like, the conservative Muslim guy come out and say, this is not what... Doesn't he say something like, this is not what the Quran is about, this is not what we're about?
Yeah. And I think that's what I like, is because it doesn't give you any easy answers. Mm-hmm. So he says that, and we're supposed to, you know, obviously agree with him, which we do, but then he has these views on women which a lot of us Westerners wouldn't hold, that his terrorist brother doesn't have a problem with, but he does. So there's, I sort of like the fact it's not giving us an easy cop-out moral message or any sort of idealized characters. It's just saying everyone's flawed. And the character of Barry, I think, is, he's what really rams home.
He's
this
so funny.
Isn't about religion. because Barry, he's a white convert to Islam, whatever. He's clearly not. He's sort of got enough knowledge to pass it off. But I can imagine that Barry has, in his time, he's probably been a communist, anarchist, yes. White supremacist.
Right. That's
He's just an angry guy who hates the system, and defines himself as being anti-authoritarian and rebellious and an insurgent. And today it happens to be Islamic fundamentalism.
Well, I want to read the trivia. I think it's the first thing of trivia in IMDb. It cracked me up really bad. Come on. But it's about Barry. Okay, yeah. It's the first item on the Four Lions trivia. I thought it was funny. According to Christopher Morris, Barry, the jihadist group leader, was based on a former BNP member who, in an attempt to out-knowledge the Asian youths he regularly assaulted, studied the Quran, and as a result, quote, accidentally converted himself and became a Muslim. So he read the Quran specifically to bully people, and that's what converted him. And I can totally see that in that character.
Yeah. So Barry's the guy who, throughout the entire film, his plan is to bomb a mosque.
Bomb the mosque.
To get the Muslims to rise up against the non-Muslims, right? And then, to prove his point, ends up punching himself in the face.
Yeah. And I love how he's like, yeah, no, we're going to bomb the mosque so to get them riled up against the West. But then they come up to him specifically making a video in which he is announcing that that's what the target is, which kind of defeats the purpose of getting people to rise up against the West.
And then you've got that lovely moment where Omar says that his cousin, I think, died defending a mosque in Bosnia in the ethnic cleansing. And that didn't, we didn't rise up here, did we?
Yeah.
No one rose up then, so it's all futile anyway.
Yeah, I mean, this is just all kind of semantics and everything. Because you guys talked about, the fine line it draws. I think what the movie does really well, and this is kind of respect from me, and also kind of annoyance from me, I think the humor of this movie, it rewrote the rules about the fineness of the line. I think it drew a very thick line, because you're able to have so many of these guys like in this other world, and you're also able to have like Barry in a complete like who's dumb in a completely different way, and then Riz Ahmed's character, who's kind of a real person, and then his brother. I think because the jokes land so well, it's able to get away with a universe that's very wide in its tone. And I kind of say that, kind of out of respect, but also like, okay, you know what? If you stack the beginning of the movie with a lot of good jokes, I think it provided itself with a lot of leeway that kind of, well, you know what? I guess it's successful at what it does, which I guess I'm fine with.
Yeah. Ah, like I said, I could talk about this movie for days, but do you know Chris Morris, the director? Did you see his other film, which was called The Day Shall Come a couple of years ago?
No. I don't know.
Which was kind of similar. It was a bit like a sort of American remake of this, about a kind of cult leader.
Oh my gosh.
And an FBI agent who's tracking him and sort of gets involved in his schemes. It's worth looking up, but it's an American remake of this. But he's an extraordinary person, and the reason I give this film the benefit of the doubt is because he is an incredibly detailed researcher.
The Day Shall Come. That's a recent movie. He's only made Four Lions and The Day Shall Come, huh?
As features, yeah. But he's done other TV work.
He's directed episodes of Veep over here.
Yeah.
That's interesting. This is crazy. Okay. Am I reading this correctly? He's an actor.
He's Denham Renham.
And he's Denham Renham from the IT Crowd.
Oh, yeah. He also did that, yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a really interesting guy. But he's a meticulous researcher and a very intelligent, very well-read guy.
Huh.
And this, the film came about because he it was very post 9/11. So this, I think it came out in 2010.
Yeah.
This film, but it sort of had its roots in the immediate post 9/11 years, where he wanted to learn a bit more about jihadis than what you would get through the TV news. So he started to look into it, and he said this one example caught his eye, which was some Yemeni jihadis wanted to ram an inflatable boat into a US warship and sink it, which did happen with the USS Cole, I believe, more successfully. But this lot tried to do it, and they got their little dinghy and they blew it up. Up by which I mean inflated it.
Okay.
and then they started to, from the shore, started to pile in their explosives, and then they just threw in too many explosives and it sank. And he said, I wanted to know who spoke first and what did they say as the dinghy sank. And then he gives other examples that he then read about. A cell in Canada wanted to assassinate the Canadian Prime Minister, but they forgot who he was. And that they'd set, they'd come up with a remote control to detonate their explosives so that they would remain safe, but it had a range of 10 feet. And the more he looked into it, the more he just found, like I say, terrorists are just idiots. Like the rest of us are all just idiots.
There are terrorists failing all around us all the time.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Absolutely. And it's a very, don't want to get all jingoistic, but it is kind of a British thing to, I think we think fewer things are off limits for humour than maybe other people do. And we view it as the kind of the remedy to terrifying things, to lampoon them.
Right, yeah.
So maybe, I don't want to overplay that point because I don't know how true it is, but traditionally that is how we would view ourselves. So, like you said, John, it was less controversial than I expected it to be. You said you expected to find loads of videos of all kinds of fatwas and the like. And it wasn't. And I was surprised too by that. It seemed to attract less ire than it might have done. And I think, does that mean that it got away with it? I think one of the things they would do differently now, if I'm going to be critical of the film, is I think they would find, if they were making it today, they'd try and find a Muslim writer to co-write it.
Yeah.
And if they couldn't find a Muslim writer who wanted to co-write it, then they would wonder why and change their opinion. But the writers are the director Chris Morris and Jesse Armstrong and Sam Bain, who wrote Peep Show, which I know you enjoyed.
Ah, yes.
John, from years ago. And also some contributions from Sam Blackwell, who is another brilliant British comedy writer. So it's kind of a comedy dream team from a British perspective. I was predisposed to like it, and I think a lot of people in this country were disposed to like it, knowing the pedigree that it had come from. And like I say, we kind of enjoy lampooning this kind of extremism, so maybe that's why it got away with it. I think time has told a little bit on it, and certainly when I started watching it, I thought, maybe they wouldn't make that joke in quite the same way now. But by the end, I thought I was going with it still.
I have.
But I'm open to persuasion.
Two things, really quick. Possibly one theory as to why there wasn't too much controversy about this movie is, I don't know. I mean, at least over here, anyway. Usually, the people who speak out are the people who. The aggrieved party, you know, usually the people who are offended or who the movie's actually making fun of. And so actually coming forward and saying, hey, I'm offended by this, it kind of, in a way, outs you as being,
a terrorist.
Yeah. and so
that's not very representative of our community.
Right. To say that's not representative. So that might be one thing. And you know what? I'll tell you what. This movie came out in 2010. If this movie came out in 2020, I think it would have been a way bigger deal because nowadays we're a lot more about you know, advocating for other groups, which is a good thing. I think it's probably mostly a good thing that sometimes it's definitely not, because, you know, people step on toes when they're like, oh, well, you know, I'm going to be offended on part of these people, and those people, you know, aren't offended, for example, which tends to happen. But, you know, I mean, that's good intentions. But in 2010, it was usually, I feel like it was more the aggrieved parties. And then the other thing, what was the other thing I was going to mention? Oh, crap. I forgot what I was
Well, while
say.
You think about it, I've got two things you've inspired there, which is one, okay. Chris Morris, I wish, you know, nowadays I think to have a Muslim writer directly involved would have been good. But at the time he said, you know, he spoke to lots of Muslim people in his research, and all of them said, yeah, bring it on. You know, because, you know, as glib as it sounds and as obvious it sounds, you know, these people aren't us. These are idiots. Mm. So we're not going to be offended by this. These people are complete idiots. So, yeah, bring it on. Lampoon them. And the other thing, oh, now I've forgotten my second thing. Can you remember your second thing?
I remember
thing,
my second thing, yeah. I mean, what you said about, you know, the British way about, you know, responding to such things with humor. I feel like, you know, you guys were, I mean, we had Pearl Harbor, but you guys had, you know, I mean, the country was bombed during. Like, the whole country was bombed, right? I mean, it was like, I mean, you were in the war. And I think something that came out of that, I think the modern sense of the British sense of humor, I heard someone say, and I don't know if you'll agree with this or not, but, like, the fantastic modern British sense of humor, it came about because of war and because, you know, you're part of a fallen empire. Like, the empire fell during the 20th century, and it's like, okay, to make sense of that, the sardonic British wit kind of comes about. It's like, okay, you know, look what we did, and, you know, look where we are, and making sense of that, making absurd sense of that is something. So my thought is, this year, it's 2021 this year, and it's the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And I'm wondering, and you know what, 9/11 probably isn't a big enough event, honestly, for this, because it was such a localized event. It wasn't like World War II. I'm wondering if perhaps our sense of humor will evolve to a British sense of humor, you know, now that it's been 20 years since 9/11. And it's like, okay, you know, we've been wrestling with this, and we've been serious about this for so long, and now it's time, you know, to really, you know, in the natural progression of dealing, you know, with the trauma that we don't understand, that we're going to get to your type of humor in the next set. So I'm wondering.
Well, I'd love to see the American version of this film. Can you imagine how far away are we from that?
Oh, it's a ways.
You need like an episode of The Office, sort of, but it takes place in one of the Twin Towers on that day.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You just volunteered. I want to see that happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll get right on.
You can do that.
What was your second thing, Phil?
I cannot remember it.
Oh, John, way to go.
Sorry.
There's so many thoughts I have about this film, but for some reason they've all deserted me.
We didn't say, I think... Shoot, I meant to research this. Katie, sorry. I think we looked this up, and the Boston Marathon bombing was in 2013, so it was, like, after this.
Right,
And I think we were talking, it was like, oh, did this inspire the Boston Marathon bombing? Probably not. But I know there was a resurgence in controversy with Four Lions in 2013. I think they actually had to pull it from some streaming services that year just because of similarities of real-life events that happened to happen.
But does that sort of bother you, too? Like, because I was a Jack Ryan fan, like, growing up as a kid, and I read all the Jack Ryan, Tom Clancy books, right? And one of the great books is The Sum of All Fears, and they're you know, they start to make a movie about it, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm assuming, is it 9/11? 9/11 happened? Because, like, The Sum of All Fears was about a Middle Eastern terrorist group that attacks the United States. And then 9/11 happens, and they rewrite it so that the bad guys are Russians, or maybe Nazis again, or Russian Nazis, or vampire Nazis. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But I just feel like,
it's almost, does it feel like an insult? Like, just because 9/11 happened doesn't mean I can't handle a movie where there's Middle Eastern terrorists.
Maybe, well, I don't know. You could take it as an insult to the terrorists. They're like, ooh, The Sum of All Fears is coming out. Cool. We'll see how much... oh, what? They changed us? What? Are you kidding me? We had no effect. So, I mean, that could be a good result of changing, yeah, the characters in Sum of All Fears. But I don't know. There's a lot of... there's so many moving parts. It kind of bugs me because it's like, okay, yeah, I want the story to be told, and maybe we need the story now more than ever, but yeah, everybody's so afraid, and I guess if I had that job, I'd be like, okay, well, I'm an entertainer, not a politician, so I just want to avoid this.
So when the day comes that this world is invaded by and dominated by aliens, then we're going to have to pull The World's End off of streaming services for at least 6 months. So people can, you know, feel better about it, I
Wouldn't
guess.
Wouldn't that be great if the aliens came over and they're like, okay, here's all the stuff we're offended by. It's like, you carry on, but stop making fun of us.
You guys were laughing at four lions? You animals!
Okay.
Well, to put a bow on four lions, I'm glad you enjoyed it as much as you did. I get the feeling you both kind of laughed at some number of the jokes.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I thought it was really funny. I had a really good time.
Yeah,
yeah, and that you're not completely at odds with the philosophy and the politics of the film, and willing to entertain the fact that the suggestion that it might be valid. I think it's absolutely a film to be questioning about and to wonder about and to constantly reevaluate. I think that's part of its strength.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good thing to say about it. I think the fact that for the past 10 days since I watched it, I was just going back and forth so many times I have all these checklists in my mind. I'm like, okay, well, I know it's funny. So I have it has that going for it, and I know it's trying to say this, and I know this is what it said here, and I felt like it was a cop out here, but I know they acknowledged that it was a cop out in this other place, and so I was like sitting there, I had like these yarn diagrams on a cork board, leading this to this, does this qualify this, and does this alleviate this, and does this make this redundant, and ultimately, for a movie to, going with my gut, I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm coming down on the side of, this movie's like Cochise for me, right? Like we met and I wasn't sure about him and now we're friends. Yeah.
Hey!
So,
I'm very pleased. That's your characteristic thoughtfulness, John. I'm very pleased that was your reaction, because that was mine too on rewatching. Okay. But I'm being serious. I'm being real. John's a thoughtful guy.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I think that's good for Four Lions. It's funny.
Yep.
All right. All right. The World's End. Okay. So. This is boy, this is packed. This is packed full of stuff. Okay, Roy, first time you've seen World's End, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Sir.
And you, John?
I saw it in the theaters, so it's been a long time. Okay. It's been, I guess, 8 years. Yeah, 8 years since I... wow, 8 years. I did... I watched this movie with Katie, and... I didn't say anything, we were watching. One thing about The World's End, and you'll get to this, but the first half hour is really straightforward. And when the first head goes off that robot with the blue goo, I had the great pleasure of watching this with someone like, wait, what? I thought this was a regular movie. So that's always a joy. Yeah, so she had no idea. But, Roy, I assumed you knew that there were blue goo robots going in.
So I didn't.
You've seen the first two, right?
I'd seen the first two, and I thought, okay, this can't just be a movie about friends. It's got to be, you know, the movie about friends in whatever kind of crazy, fantastic context, right? And I think that I'd simply heard that, I mean, The World's End, right? It sounds like an end-of-world kind of movie, and I didn't know that they were talking about a pub until the movie started, but I kind of, like, when that moment happened, I was like, okay, here we go, right? Like, so it wasn't a surprise to me, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, it couldn't be a surprise, but, I mean, it was nice of them to name the pub something as obvious as The World's End, because it's just like, could it just be the name of the pub? Like, maybe it could just be the name of the pub.
That is a not unheard of pub name.
Yeah.
There is a World's End in the city center where I live, and in other places. It's not purely a fiction from the film.
Was it built in the last eight years?
No.
Oh, wow.
So I did have that thought where, like, before the head popped off, where I thought, if this movie is just about friends figuring out that they've gotten older and that, you know, people change and but they're still friends or whatever, I'm going to be okay with this film if that's where the direction goes, right? So anyway, what would be great, because this movie is about pub cultures, if we had someone from England who could talk about this film.
Well, funny you should mention that, because I have a can ready to go. There you go.
Nice.
This is which pint is this? Is this number 9?
Not 9, but it's closer to 9 than 1.
Wow, nice. Say. Nice work.
So I
did get the recording time wrong because of the time difference.
So. you're going to sum it up, but my favorite thing about this film, the whole conceit of this film is that these friends have to, like, solve this crazy world-ending scenario while getting increasingly drunk. Like, it's going to get harder for them to do it as it's getting more difficult to defeat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it's really clever. But go ahead, sir.
Okay. So I need to find my notes. I'm quite intimidated about summing this up, because it's a film which, on the one hand, has a very segmented and definite structure, which you'd think would help with the summing up, but it also makes it incredibly intimidating because there's so much going on and it is so carefully plotted that I have to get it right, or at least I'll try to. So there is a guy called Gary King, who is 40-ish years old, and he has never sort of got past his glory days as a teenager / young adult. And he is trying to get his gang back together. He wants to reunite with his friends to complete a pub crawl that he failed to complete in his younger days in his hometown of Newton Haven, which is to have a drink in 12 pubs on the so-called Golden Mile. And he's obviously not adapted well to adult life, whereas his friends have adapted pretty well, and they've got stable lives and jobs and are living happily in middle age. They're not really into it. He's very much into it. He hasn't moved on past 1990, I feel you. And so they go to the first pub on their stop, which is called the First Post, appropriately enough. And this is what we know in the UK as a Wetherspoons. So there's a pub company called Wetherspoons, who are detestable in many different ways.
Are they like our Applebee's?
I don't really know what Applebee's is, but they're run by a Brexit supporting tycoon who is just the most, well, I don't want to get sued, but he's taken sort of a Walmart approach to the pub industry, if you sell cheap, stack them high,
which is the joke that the first two pubs are exactly the same. Well, exactly, all of them are pretty much the same, right?
Yeah, all of them are, but especially the first two. So they go in and it's stripped of all character, devoid of any of their memories.
Well, and actually, you know, I mean, I can say this, but I mean, it's kind of American looking. Is that another kind of aspect of it? Yeah.
Possibly. I didn't think that, but you can say that.
Okay.
that's your right to say that. I couldn't possibly comment. but I'm sure that
it looks like an Applebee's.
Yeah, it does. It looks just like an Applebee's. An Applebee's is a cheaper chain restaurant here. It looks like those two pubs. Okay, yeah, so
yeah. It's just a chain restaurant here. Yeah.
So they go. They are disappointed, and then they go to the second pub in their list of 12, which turns out to be exactly the same. I think, you know, literally the same set. That's the joke. I think they call it at one point the Starbuckification, and that's kind of one of the themes of this film: homogeneity. And making everything the same, and the blandishments of globalization and what have you. And the pub, the second pub they go to, which is the same as the first one, is called the Old Familiar, which sets a pattern for the names of the pubs, describing the action in the film. So it's very familiar, because it is a copy of the first pub they're in. And at this point, Sam turns up, who is the sister of Ollie, one of Gary's group of friends, who Gary and Steve both had a crush on in school, and they immediately begin to bicker. The third pub is the famous Cock, which they're not in for very long, because Gary has been barred for life, hence the name the famous Cock, because he was a bit of a cock and everyone knows about it.
But he fulfills the goal there, yes. Because he finds enough not finished beers on the patio,
on the table outside. Yeah. So he's kept to his vow of having a drink in each. But the others by this point are getting fairly bored of the whole venture. Then the Cross Hands is where things really kick off, when they're having another unsatisfactory drink. Tempers are short, they're bickering, they're realizing they haven't got much in common anymore. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is this where... Yes, this is where Gary tries to play on the fact that his mother had passed away. This was one of his ways of luring people in, guilt-tripping them, to accommodating and enabling his fantasy. But then when he goes to the toilet... his phone rings, which he's left on the table, and it's his mother, so they know that he has been lying to them. Meanwhile, in the toilet, Gary is not pleased with how things are going. He's frustrated. He punches the wall that he'd punched years ago as a young man, and he tries to bond with a youngster who he perhaps sees himself in, who doesn't want anything to do with him. And it escalates quickly into a fight, and before you know it, he's just like super slams the kid down onto a urinal and pops his head off in an explosion of blue ink.
What a fortunate turn of events that was like an alien robot trying to take over the world, because
otherwise he'd be wanted for murder.
Big dead teenager, right?
But I know what you mean, Roy. Is up to this point, it's been a completely different film, and one that I was 100% on board for. If it had carried on like that, I would have loved that, because, you know, there's lots of things we might be able to relate to, you know, going back to your hometown, you can't go home again, that kind of thing, the transience of youth and the disappointment of growing older and all that kind of stuff. So I would have been there for that film, absolutely. But we get the best of both worlds, because all of a sudden we're in a sci-fi apocalyptic action movie. So they come into the toilet to confront Gary. More of the blue ink robots turn up, and a fight ensues, and they come to realize we have been invaded and somewhat replaced by these things, which I think they eventually settle on calling blanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After suggesting a few alternatives. But they decide the best thing they can do, much at Gary's insistence, is to carry on what they're doing, which is possibly good strategy because they don't want to give on, they don't want to let on that they know about the robots. But it also plays into what Carrie wants to do, which is to finish his pub crawl. So they go to the good.
Does that strike you as a good strategy? Like, I mean, no. I they don't want to like tip off that they know something's wrong, but also maybe it would be completely reasonable for four or five middle-aged men to decide after seven pints that they're in over their heads, right? And no one would think differently or weirdly if they called it off at that point.
It's a conceit. I think you just kind of decide to go along with it there.
From Gary's viewpoint, right? He was doing, like, he had it so in his head. He's like, I have to do this. I have to do this thing, you know, with my friends. I have to accomplish this thing. Because even though the world was ending, it was still, in his mind, it was still the only thing in his mind. And so it's funny that he was able to somehow, despite the world invasion, he's like, no, we have to do this. He used the excuse of the world, and you could tell that his mind was working that way. I'm going to use the excuse of the invasion of the world to make sure that they do this. He was just twisting, twisting their reality to just continue, because he's still, like, it's almost like the world ending wasn't of concern to him. It was just another thing he was manipulating to make sure it happened, what he wanted to
do. Exactly, which is a heavy-handed example, but it is very much, I think, intended to be an example of the power of addiction, which obviously we come to later in the film. That, you know, anything can be grist to that mill, anything can be turned into an excuse or justification for indulging, he said as he reached for another sip of beer.
Nice.
So, and it's funny because, like, when at the beginning of the movie, he's telling his story about his attempt at the Golden Mile when he was a teenager, right? But I'm pretty sure he's telling that story to an AA group, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they go to the Good Companions, which is so named because when they are there, they are trying to keep up this pretense of just being five guys out for a drink. They're not there for very long. They go to the Trusty Servant next, which is so called because there they meet the Reverend Green, who was their drug dealer when they were young and is now the trusty servant, quote unquote, of the invading force, in the sense that he's one of their cooperative human collaborators who's cleaned himself up and no longer dealing drugs because he's trying to stay in with the invading aliens. They then go on to the two-headed dog, where they meet Sam again, the love interest, while outside in the beer garden having a ciggy, a pair of identical twins who are now replaced by these robots attack Sam and Gary. Another fight ensues. Another wonderful fight. I have to say, all the fight choreography scenes in this film are fantastic, in my opinion. Then it's on to, where do they go next? The Mermaid, where there is a school disco going on. Is this a thing in America, school disco? Retro night kind of thing?
I mean, we always have them at school.
But you don't have 30-year-olds dressing up in school uniform in nightclubs pretending to be 18-year-olds.
Not often.
No, that's not... Ever. Yeah, of course, you know, we're bad. I mean, we don't hang out in the bars here a lot. So maybe that's a big thing that everyone does that just no one told us, but I'm pretty sure no.
That's true. Yeah, maybe it's that. So also, there's not a whole lot of school uniform wearing over here.
No, that's true. You've all got those jackets with, like, a big letter on.
Yeah.
That's
right. That's what you're wearing. Well, if you're a jock, and I mean... You got to keep the nerd's blood off of it, though. Yeah.
I've never adorned myself in a Letterman's jacket myself.
Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Letterman's jacket, yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that also... Didn't he have a chat show?
Oh, yeah, David Letterman. Yeah.
Yeah.
No relation.
No relation.
I don't think he invented the Letterman's jacket.
The Letterman's jacket, they give it to the... I think nerds get Letterman's jackets, too. Like, if you excel at something in high school,
They call lettering at, right? So, like, yeah. I have a kid who lettered in soccer and cross country and track, right? So he has a. We never bought the jacket, but he's got like a big patch, a letter patch to sew on a jacket if he wanted to.
It's
and
like
got
the
a
letter of your high school that goes on the jacket. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, this is the. So the letterman's jackets were the big puffy things. It's like. They're also designated with the high school that they lettered in, and and usually it's athletics. Athletes wear them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
That was educational. Thank you.
Nice.
While in the mermaid, Stephen learns the truth about the situation from what's he called? I can't remember the actor's name. David. Something. He's in Game of Thrones, he's in Talk 2, he's been all kinds of things. Broadchurch, very well respected actor playing I can't remember the character's name now.
And Harry Potter. Doggone it, the most
okay, oh yes, I believe so. And he explains that we've been targeted by this galactic civilization who are replacing us and inveigling their way into our society. They then move on to the beehive, by which time everyone is incredibly drunk, and they are met by Pierce Brosnan, who is one of their old school teachers, who fills in the remaining holes in the plot and says, yes, there's this galactic civilization out there, they've seen something in us, they want us to be part of their conglomerates. So again, we're getting back to this globalization homogeneity concept again. They are unconvinced by this offer, and Andy, who is Gary's best friend, who has previously been teetotal until getting drunk on this pub crawl, says he blooming hates this town, and another massive fight ensues in which they ultimately prevail. But then they're just replaced by the empties, and Pierce Brosnan are just replaced by more versions of the same, letting us know that ultimately they can just rebuild, repair, and possibly the fight is futile.
Yeah.
Sam leaves in her car. The rest of the gang repair to the smokehouse, which is, I think, like a cricket pavilion where they had smoked some substances when they were younger. And there's a bit of a summit, a bit of a climax. They're not sure whether to trust each other. They're certainly not sure whether to trust Gary's plan to carry on. But there's some measure of reconciliation, ultimately. They do resolve to complete the Golden Mile. Unfortunately, Pete is waylaid shortly after they leave the smokehouse, lured into engaging with the enemy by a simulacrum of the school bully who tormented him. And even though I think he knows it's not real, his feelings bubble over and he's sufficiently distracted into confronting and fighting the simulacrum, and then he is captured by the baddies. They go on to pub number 10, which is King's Head, which the picture on the pub sign is Edgar Wright in a...
Is it Simon Pegg?
It's Edgar Wright, I think.
Oh.
In the picture outside the King's Head, yeah.
Okay, because it should be Simon Pegg's because his name is King.
Because of King. Yeah. I guess it's a nod to the... In fact, the director is the king of the operation. I don't know.
Yeah.
And at this point, Andy has really had enough of Gary's hijinks and exhorts him to put the pint down and maybe just give up on stuff. But Gary decides to commit to it 100%. He has his pint and he flees to the next pub. By this point, the whole of the town is on alert. There's huge hordes of luminous-eyed robots slash not robots pursuing them. There is a a statue that they previously thought was modern art and has kind of become this walking sentinel, also chasing them. They reach the hole in the wall, the penultimate pub. He has another drink after another big fight with Andy. Steve comes back and drives a car through the wall, hence the name Hole in the Wall. But before they can join him in the car is overrun by robots slash not robots, and Andy and Gary run onto the final pub, which is the World's End. En route, Andy recovers his wedding ring from the tummy of a of a robot. Didn't mention that earlier. Like I say, there's a lot in this film. It's very densely plotted. And then in the World's End, Gary is met by this beautiful, bubbling, foaming pint of lager. There's a further confrontation between Andy and Gary about his alcoholism. But ultimately, when Gary goes to pull his final pint, the pulling of the pump flips a switch, which brings them down via a lift into the bowels of the alien operation, where there are legions of blanks ready to go. A lot of people they recognize, including the people they've left lost along the way in this journey, and they have a confrontation with the, I don't know if it's an artificial intelligence or just the manifestation of an alien or something, but they talk to
it's Locutus.
Yes, it is Locutus of Borg, absolutely. And he tries to appeal to their reason. He tries to make it sound like, you know, we're bringing civilization to the galaxy, we're bringing sensibleness, we're bringing shared values. You know, you should really get on board with us. If we all just get along, if we're all part of the same whole, everything will be fine. And then in an uncomfortable pre-Brexit diatribe, Gary goes on to reject this, to be quite antagonistic and rude, and basically says humanity, which you can read Britain, just wants to get drunk, mess around, get wasted, and generally be irresponsible and have a good time. Which is basically what we said to the European Union in 2016. And the outcome is about the same, whereby the land is scorched, the network, which is the name of the alien intelligence driving this, gives up on us and sets off some kind of pulse, which basically then just destroys the world largely. Although our heroes make it out of the immediate blast zone and survive into the post-apocalyptic wilderness. They get separated. Some of them have happy endings. And at the very end, we see Gary with the young versions of his posse, who were part of that host of clones in the alien base, who is taken under his wing and is now on the side of robot rights in this post-apocalyptic, post-network world. And the credits roll.
And he's drinking water.
And he's drinking water now. Yeah, yep. Sorry, that is very crucial.
I remember I saw the movie the one time, and I remember leaving the theater when I saw this movie and just being like, I don't get the water, you know? Like, because I thought, okay, first of all, I mean, I have so many questions about the end of the World's End. I think it's just so much. I'm just amazed that Edgar Wright provided something so kind of strangely confusing to me, because I feel like, you know, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, it was like, okay, you know what? Humanity fights for its rights, you know? Humanity fights to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But I get the sense, you know, you kind of get the sense that, that, you know, when they're fighting, when they're talking to the network and saying, screw you, network, we're going to be ourselves, you know, don't come here, and the network is just like, all right, fine, you know, I guess we'll leave. I get the sense that the movie is saying, oh, okay, that was the wrong decision. Maybe conformity is the answer, you know? Maybe we shouldn't, you know, because it's like, okay, maybe humanity shouldn't have the free will because because it's like, okay, it's one thing to have free will and you know, and build things and progress and do stuff, but if you're just going to, you know, have a good time and tell people to piss off, you know, maybe you need someone to come and take control of you. And that's kind of what I feel like the movie is saying, which is, like, I don't hate that idea, but also it's so absurd to see in a movie. Like, you can't have that be the message in a movie, you know, because every single movie ever made, thousands and thousands of movies, is stand up for yourself and be an individual and don't let anybody take you over. But I kind of feel like The World's End is saying, you know what, maybe be a part of something bigger than yourself.
Well, again, it's maybe that British absurdist nihilistic point of view. Mm-hmm. We don't want the Hollywood answer of we fight for our freedom and everything's fine. We fight for our freedom and maybe it was stupid because maybe we were drunk. But at the end of the day, most of the characters do have kind of a happy ending, and maybe it's saying, you know, there's no good answer. So you can be taken over and be homogenous, but you'll lose yourself, or you can stand up for yourself and remain individualistic, but you'll lose everything and have to rebuild in the process. There's no perfect Hollywood answer.
Does it hurt in this film that we see in the wasteland after the end of the scene of The World's End, and we see a rapper for a cornetto, but no one actually got to enjoy that cornetto?
Well, that's what everyone was waiting for, the end of the Cornetto trilogy.
That's representative. I'm glad it was so throwaway. This is Edgar Wright's most dismal movie, you know, like his most his most nihilistic one, like, for that reason. That's like, that's emblematic of that. It's like, okay, you know what, you're not going to get the Cornetto because, you know, it's we don't have the safe answers to get the Cornetto.
Do you know, I'd never thought about it until you just said that. I'd never thought about how nihilistic this ending is compared to Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, where we do get a nice button on it, a nice happy ending.
Yeah, it's weird. Well, and honestly, you know, so we watched the movie over here, and, you know, like, let's watch the last 10 minutes with the director's commentary. And I was surprised to hear Edgar Wright say stuff like, you know, maybe free will isn't such a great idea. Like, okay, sure, man.
Maybe with his tongue in his cheek a little bit, or not, do you think?
I think a little bit. Because I think maybe I'm getting hung up on, okay, what are the two things that are being, you know, what are the two forces? Is it free will? Is it standing up? Is it freedom? Is it that stuff? I think, kind of like, I guess, in A Quiet Earth, he's just way more interested in dealing with addiction and friendship, you know, in a sideways kind of way. It's like, okay, whether or not, you know, whether or not aliens take over or whether or not you defeat the aliens, maybe how you do it is important. Maybe there's a difference in the valiance of you know, standing up for humanity and also just, and standing up for yourself and just saying, oh, I only care about myself, piss off, or sacrificing yourself for humanity. I think he was more interested in the method rather than, you know, which side is right. But unsure, though.
So I think the most important thing to talk about with this movie is our own experiences with our best pub crawls, and we should probably start with Phil because he's the only one here who actually drinks alcohol.
Mm-hmm. You guys don't drink at all, is that right?
That's correct, but I do have a story to tell.
Is it going too far if I ask if you ever have drunk?
So it's not. That doesn't bother me for you to ask at all. My wife and I had a vacation in Jamaica, and every time a drink came out, my wife wasn't sure if they'd had forgotten to withhold the alcohol. I got to be the I was like the dipstick, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. So having never downed an entire alcoholic beverage, but having tasted it a few times just so my wife would not accidentally. And that's the extent of it. Let's see. I cook with wine. Like if I'm going to make chili and the recipe calls for beer, no problem. But okay. As far as just like knocking them back, no.
I was on a date with a girlfriend, and you know she ordered something alcoholic, and I think just for whatever reason I was like in a mood, and she's like, oh yeah, do you want to try? I'm like, okay, fine, I'll try it. I'll have a sip of it, and I was like, I was kind of amazed at how great it made me feel, just like in that. But that's it for me.
Okay, well. You're correct. It makes you feel great. Uh-huh. You should do it more. That's my advice.
Okay.
So you have no pub crawls to speak of.
Oh, no, I do. But go ahead.
Oh, you do? Okay, well, I don't know if I've had great pub crawls. I think I've had great nights out. But, I mean, 12 places, that is not a thing. That does not happen, as far as I'm aware. you might get to the fourth or fifth. And by then you think, well, we'll just stay here, shall we? Mm-hmm. I mean, 12 pints. I think he said that he would have to have a pint in each one for it to be legitimate. 12 pints is an insane amount of alcohol. There used to be a thing in the 80s and early 90s. There was a thing in this country where you had to have 10 pints. That was a big sort of pop culture thing. Everyone was talking about, oh, I had 10 pints last night. And that is way too much. I would say... Like three pints is a nice session. Four is a bit cheeky. Five, you've had plenty. Six, anything past 6 pints is for a special occasion, as far as I'm concerned.
So
12, my goodness.
So at 6 pints, is that where you start to question if your mates have been replaced by aliens?
You're probably wishing they had been replaced by aliens at that point, because they'll be talking absolute nonsense.
Okay.
Apart from once, I would say the best pub crawl I've had was when I met my partner, who sends her regards, by the way. She still holds you in great esteem and affection.
Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Mickey. Yeah, she's been voting lately on our polls. So.
She has, yeah. She's taking a keen interest. Yeah. And that was... I was not long single, shall we say. And it had been suggested that we should meet up, and she lived in the city where my brother lived, where I didn't live, and so I said, "Well, I'll come up. I just want to see my brother. I didn't want to really meet someone new, but I thought, it'd be nice to spend a weekend with my brother in the north." And there was a football match on, an England football match. That kicked off at about 12:30. So my brother and I went to see that in the pub, and we started drinking at 12:30, and we carried on drinking, doing it's called the Otley Run, which is a known pub crawl in Leeds. And so we were pretty wasted by about 5:00, and then we carried on, and I didn't meet Mickey until about 11:00, by which point I've been drinking for about 11 hours. And then I carried on drinking with her until about 2 or 3 in the morning, by which point I've been drinking for about 14 hours. So that's my longest pub crawl.
That's amazing. Wow. So you must have been so confident by the time you met Mickey.
The confidence that being... hammered gives you, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, that worked out.
Yeah.
It did. Here we go. 14 years later, here we are.
There you go.
Beautiful.
Okay, so my story is a little different. This is me and my brothers, and I think this happened just maybe last year in Utah. And so it was one of my brother's 40th birthdays, and for whatever reason, my older brother Josh has gotten it in his head that we need to grandly celebrate each other's 40th birthdays. And this is the brother who we ended up renting the movie theater for to see Cobra. And I think earlier in the day we did a romantic brothers sleigh ride in the snow. but then part of it was we did a root beer float crawl. which turned out to be a much worse idea than we thought. But so, in Utah, we started on Brigham Young University campus, and we went to the creamery at 9th, where we got Lavelle's Vanilla with, and they just like gave us cups of ice cream and said, "Go over to the soda fountain and fill it up." And that was pretty. That was a letdown, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever, we did it. Then we went to a restaurant called the Brick Oven, and they make their own root beer. And so they brought out these huge glasses with root beer, and then the ice cream was like 4 scoops of giant ice cream around the rim, like lemon wedges, I guess, right? Wow. And that was really good. That was really, really good. Then we went to a place called Station 22 on Center Street, and they gave us, again, a glass of ice cream.
These are far away from each other. You're not walking this, are you?
We're driving this, which is okay because it's even though, like, I guess a stroke could have happened, no one was getting particularly drunk, right? At Station 22, we ended up with they just had bottles of root beer, and I went with Virgil's. I'm a big fan of Virgil's. That's pretty good. Then we ended up at a place called Brooker's Founding Fathers. John, have you been there?
No, never heard of it.
Okay, it's this weird ice cream place on BYU campus where everything is, like, themed after the, like, founding fathers of our country. So we had Aaron Burr's Murderous Shot, which was a black Madagascar vanilla ice cream root beer float, and the ice cream was black. It was that one was kind of gross. And then our next stop was A&W root beer, but we didn't make it because everyone wanted to die halfway through the stupid Aaron Burr's Murderous Shot. So
yeah, the ice cream is what kills you, right?
Oh my goodness, it was bad.
Like, you
this
can't.
This is like 5,000 calories in about an hour and a half, yeah, or so.
That's the funny thing. That's a funny thing we do. We.
Yeah, now I've heard of this. Mm-hmm. We don't really have it here, but I've heard of it through another American acquaintance. And so you asked before, Roy, about who was going to suffer the most from having 12 pints, me of beer or John of ice cream.
Mm hmm.
But put those hands together. That's the ultimate punishment.
Do they have beer floats? Not root beer floats, but just beer floats? I wonder how that would
maybe
work.
Not. I don't know.
12 of those. 12 pints and 12 pints.
Oh, man. So, yeah. Anyway, that was my experience. So it was at a separate occasion. It wasn't a crawl, but me and my brother Jake, we did a challenge where we each drank a 6-pound glass of milkshake. Yeah, it didn't work out. We each drank 4 pounds and then vomited that 4 pounds back up. During which experience, we discovered that coming back up, it's still cold.
Wow.
And it's still delicious. Like, I got to taste it twice.
Oh my God.
Yeah, those bulimics, they know where it's at.
I love the fact we have this scholarly, mature discussion about terrorism and whether you should joke about it and the limits of comedy. We stroked our chins thoughtfully, and then Roy waxed lyrical about enjoying his refrigerated upchuck and said, "Those bulimics know where it's at."
So I will say, after our root beer float crawl, that's when we did our stupid sleigh ride in the snow. And we were probably saying stupid brother things, and our sleigh ride driver felt that inspired to share with us that a horse once bit off his nipple, and he super glued it back on.
Oh my gosh.
That was a memorable day. Oh.
How has the non-drinker had better pub crawls than I've had?
But I think after the root beer float debacle, we were supposed to go to some wings place and do like a spicy food challenge, but I think we just all went into a coma.
Yeah, that sounds.
Woke up in time to watch Cobra. That was it.
Too much, man. Yeah. That was a too big a deal. Okay, holy cow.
You guys have any final thoughts on World's End?
Oh, so many. How do you think it ranks in the trilogy?
Okay. That's a good question.
Okay, that's a good question because we just finished the trilogy. This is the third. Yeah, because mm-hmm. we watched. And we'd seen both of those others before. This is the only one. Well, I guess, yeah. I guess the only one that Roy hasn't seen. But I want to ask Roy first, since this is the first time you saw it. How would you rank them?
Okay. Because I've only seen Hot Fuzz once, right?
And it was with us? On the
yeah,
podcast.
It was with us. Okay. I think Hot Fuzz is really funny. Shaun of the Dead is the one I've seen probably the most times. Man, I don't know. So this one, is it? Maybe this one may have been the best, but it's probably not my favorite. It might be my number three. So I'm probably going to say Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and then this film.
Right. I think that's the usual order. I think for me, I don't know. I'm kind of thinking, I think I might like Hot Fuzz the best right now. Like if you ask me right now, and then maybe this one. And I think I might put Shaun of the Dead third. Mm. I think just because, you know, we just barely watched it a couple months ago, and it was like, it felt especially 2004 more than usual, you know? But the other ones, they kind of feel a little bit more timeless in the Edgar Wright way.
So, what I do love about this film is, like, you just have the one character who's totally stuck in his past, and the way they illustrate how stuck in his past he is with his obsession for Sisters of Mercy.
Yes.
Oh, the soundtrack in this film, we should talk about the soundtrack, is amazing. Oh,
we'll get there.
I have a few awards lined up. So, but that's fine. I do love, like, I mean, okay. Phil, is anybody like, does anybody have like a Sisters of Mercy tattoo over there? It seems
I've
like
never
they're
seen
so
one,
specifically gone,
it.
You know? Like, it's such, like, the Sisters of Mercy is so specifically kind of like an early 90s sort of thing. Unless I'm wrong.
People
I don't
have
know.
Tattoos if... here for everything. There is nothing, given that it's a permanent mark on your body, there is nothing too trivial, it seems, that cannot be turned into a tattoo here. And I have none, and I have no intention to get any. And it fascinates me how casual people are about getting them, and how trivial the subject matter can be.
I can't even, like, keep the same, like, wallpaper on my phone for more than a week.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I can't, and so, but like my daughter who just got married and she's 20 or 21, like she talked about wanting to get a tattoo, and I said, okay, but like what you like now isn't what you're going to like in 5 years, and what you like now most definitely isn't going to be what you maybe like in 30 years or 40 years. And she said, I know, I'll be really smart about it. I'll get something that's really meaningful and will always be meaningful. So it's like a paper airplane. Like she got a tattoo of a paper airplane, and maybe that's got a really deep meaning for her. I don't know. But
that, well, Gary King is an example of the opposite of that, where he is still very much passionate about things he was in his youth.
Yeah. So, all right. So, Phil, then, what's your take? How do you rank these films?
Well, I would put World's End top. And I think it is because, you know, I don't want to lean on this too much because goodness knows in recent weeks and months and years there's been plenty of reason to not be proud of being British, and I do not want to come across as a jingoistic kind of person, but this is the kind of Britain that I cleave to. To me it's like, compared with Hot Fuzz, which is a fantastic film, brilliant, hilarious, but it's playing on what it knows is a very stereotypical picture postcard version of Britain that doesn't really exist apart from a few tiny pockets. It's, you know, it's based on a 1950s idyll that doesn't exist anymore, whereas this one is, you know, the beating jugular of modern Britain. For better or for worse, the lameness of it, the borderline substance abuse or not so borderline substance abuse. This is not that you can draw too many parallels between this and Four Lions, but there's something in that which is it's Britain unmasked. It's not trying to do the picture postcard thing. It's not trying to be a Guy Ritchie pastiche of Britishness. It's quite a stark, not necessarily realistic, but unvarnished view of contemporary Britain. So, and I relate to it as well on the level of going back to your hometown I don't know if this is something you guys can relate to, but you know, the lure of home and simultaneously finding it nostalgically pleasing but also limiting, and glad that you've left it behind, and that kind of conflict, knowing people who have moved on to a greater or lesser degree. There was just, like you said, Roy, if the film was about nostalgia, about moving on or not moving on, and old friends and old acquaintanceships, that would have been a great film. So it speaks to me on many levels. That's why I picked this one. Pubs, pub crawls, beer culture, abusing alcohol, hometowns, nostalgia, 90s. That's just a lot about it that speaks to me.
Oh, perfect. So, yeah, you're the perfect.
Yeah, it could be clientele. Yeah.
So, what's your second favorite of the trilogy?
That's really hard. Probably A Dead Heat.
That's an American movie.
I want to say Shaun of the Dead, but I can't imagine putting Hot Fuzz last. But I think Shaun of the Dead, just because it was the first one and there were so many arresting scenes, because it was the first one, you know, the Queen song, pool cue.
When I think of
shooting his mother in the face,
I think of the pool cues. Yeah, Shaun of the Dead. I think it struck us just perfectly at that time, especially, and so I always have the fondness. Like, there's always like a sort of perfection to Shaun of the Dead, but I think you know, Hot Fuzz is just a little bit, well.
Polished, isn't it? There's something satisfying about Hot Fuzz.
Yeah,
very polished. It's more of a pure action movie. I don't know. I get what you mean. It's very hard to draw a line between those two.
Yeah. No, we shouldn't even ask the question. I almost changed my mind just now, but I better just let it go.
Well, you asked me first, and I don't know. I mean, whatever. I guess I could just throw them up in the air. But you guys ready for some awards?
Yeah, let's do awards.
Let's do, because I think where Phil is, it's now 8 o'clock in the morning or something. So
yeah. It's 1:45.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you've probably got time for another 2 or 3 pints, so just keep going. But while you're drinking, think of what you think the best movie title of these three films are. And go ahead, Phil.
I did write these down. I'm going to say Four Lions. Are you aware of Three Lions?
I know that, this is all I know. On the national team soccer jersey, you got three lions.
Yeah. So that's basically it. And there's a well-known song that is sung on the soccer games about three lions. So this is,
well,
taking something that is so wholesome and innocent and laddishly British, and then adding a lion to make it something much more subversive about terrorists is quite interesting.
So New Order has a song about soccer, and I assume that that you guys have to play that song at every football match. Is it called World in Motion?
Yeah, that is generally viewed as the best of the soccer pop songs.
Speaking of which, John and I are going to see New Order and the Pet Shop Boys next year in California. Yeah. That's
the plan. Really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a lineup.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it should be really
cool. We're hoping they throw in some, you know, electronic songs with,
yeah, they're both there.
Bernard Sumner and Neil Tennant collaborating.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Hoping that's the case, because, yeah, maybe, but, you know, I guess I'm missing everybody. But, yeah, that's the plan. Well, hey, I have a question about, because you said, like, is World in Motion, like, officially sanctioned, sort of like, this is the football song this year kind of thing, kind of like the number one Christmas song sort of thing, has a, like, is there like a football song every year?
Yes.
Okay.
There is, and some are officially sanctioned and some aren't. I think that one wasn't 100%, but it's still viewed as the best one.
Nice.
Not least for John Barnes rapping.
Yeah. Okay, that's John Barnes. Okay, I'm not sure who that is, but I remember that in the thing.
He's an incredibly talented winger. And not rapper.
Oh. The guy who raps in that song is a soccer player. Okay, I didn't know that.
No.
Oh yeah. No, he's a very interesting, intelligent guy, and an incredibly gifted footballer.
Okay. Okay.
All right, John, what's your favorite title?
I'm going to go with The Quiet Earth.
Mm. I'm also going with The Quiet Earth, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going with Quiet Earth.
Okay. Well, then what's your favorite movie poster, John?
Quiet an Earth.
Okay, what about you, Phil? What's your favorite movie poster?
Anything that's not The Quiet Earth, because the poster I saw ruins the last shot of the film.
Oh, that's why it's such a great poster.
Which is utterly unforgivable.
Which I know
it makes
crazy.
A great poster, but it's ridiculous.
It is very ridiculous.
Literally the last shot of the film.
Yeah.
Can you imagine like a poster of The Sixth Sense where it just like it's him telling Bruce Willis, "You're the ghost." So anyway, oh, I'm sorry, Phil. In case you haven't seen The Sixth Sense, oh, I'm sorry.
Anybody hearing it.
I was just joking. Okay. So the best movie poster, I chose The Quiet Earth, but Phil, you're just saying that's just last place, and the other two, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Your favorite tagline, Phil, from any of these three films?
Well, in a similar way to the previous category, four lines for not having one, because the other two were terrible. I don't know about you, but the DVD I had of The Quiet Earth, it was some, you know, very cheap run of, you know, it's not from a real studio. I think it's been re-released more recently with proper special features and what have you, but this was just like a very cheaply made one, and the tagline on it was something like, "The end of the world was just the beginning."
Yes.
I'm like, that's a tagline for a different film.
Yeah.
If it was a big Disney production, you know, maybe that would be an appropriate tagline, but that's, you know, just the beginning. Well, that makes it sound like we're about to go on some fantastical, magical journey rather than watch someone put on a negligee and make a printout of Hitler.
But only put on the negligee after 10 solid minutes of full frontal frolicking.
Yeah.
All right, John, what's your favorite tagline?
There's a hidden tagline on the poster for The World's End, which beneath the other tagline, there's another tagline that says, "Barmageddon Begins."
Oh, that's really good. I didn't see that.
Yeah.
So the quiet...
So it's...
Yeah, the Quiet Earth poster says the creation of our mind should be a blessing, not a curse to mankind, and I thought it would sound really smart when I read it.
Wasn't that just a quote by somebody? Didn't like
from Einstein?
Yeah, the tagline is like, it's Albert kind of Einstein said this.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to do some alternate taglines because the ones that they gave us are just rubbish. So, John, give us your three alternate taglines.
Okay. My alternate tagline for The Quiet Earth is, "Being the last man on Earth isn't nearly as bad as being the second to last man."
All right.
My four lions is, "Don't worry, terrorists are just as incompetent as you are." And my World's End tagline is, "You'd think saving the world would be more difficult while you're drunk out of your mind, but, well, here we are."
All right, Phil, what do you got?
For The Quiet Earth, I've got, "Even when you've got the whole planet, three is still a crowd."
I love your tagline voice. You have a really good tagline voice.
Yeah.
For World's End, I've got, "Drinking is bad, ... but really, it's awesome." And for four lines, I've got, "Libs, watch if you dare."
Okay, so for The Quiet Earth, I have, "Quiet, a good movie." Mm-hmm. For the four lions, I put, "Jihad is harder than it looks." And The World's End, I just have, "Have mercy, sisters." So there's
my...
Nice.
All right, best titular line. This is the first time we've done this. New award. It'll be interesting to see how this goes. I think all three of these movies, they said the titular line, but for a couple of them, I couldn't find quotes, so I just had to go with it. But anyway, Phil, did you understand this category and or come up with something?
I'm reacting to it in real time.
Okay.
I will go with... I quite like the Quiet Earth when he's going quite crazy. And he says he's now the president of this
Quiet Earth, yeah.
Quiet Earth. And then he promotes himself to God shortly afterwards.
That sounds accurate. I bet you guys are right. What I remembered hearing was, boy, the Earth sure is quiet. It's a quiet Earth, in fact. So,
yeah, that's wrong.
You guys are right.
Yeah. No, wrong. Yeah.
Okay, well, what do you have for the Quiet Earth, John?
No. It's exactly what Phil said. That's when the Quiet Earth was said. Yeah.
Okay. What about Four Lions, you guys?
At the right before they go out to blow themselves up, I think they toast each other, and they say it's the Four Lions again or something. It's like, mm-hmm. We're the Four Lions, and they're all jumping and yelling. Yeah. I can't remember the exact line because we kind of decided on this in the middle of our watching. But
yeah. Okay. Is that what you got, Phil?
Yep.
Okay, I didn't remember when they said it, so I kind of went with what's better than two Corys? Is it Four Lions? I think that's what they probably said.
Good. I like your internal research that you do.
Okay. All right, The World's End. So what's the line from The World's End? I think they say it about 3 billion times. But
yes, they do.
Go ahead.
Let me just say, when Simon Pegg actually gets to the bar, The World's End, and I think Nick Frost knocks the drink out of his hand, and he just yells, "This is The World's End, man!" You know, and like he didn't even get a sip of it.
So I picked the same thing, so I'll just get that out of the way. That's the quote I had. What about you, Phil?
Yeah, thirded.
Oh, very good.
Best use of The World's End.
I couldn't claim to know for sure, but Simon Pegg's portrayal of an alcoholic is very convincing, I think.
All right. Favorite opening credits, Phil?
I quite like the Quiet Earth's sunrise with the interloper seagulls, you're quite right, that shouldn't have been there. But it sets the tone for it. You just see, I assume slightly sped up because it rises very fast, but this silent, shimmering sun just sets the tone for this slightly oddball quiet film.
It's great look. Great. No, that's what I have too.
Oh, and me. Yeah, it was really good. The super red sky, right? And it was really good. All right, your favorite technology then, John?
Okay, I have two honorable mentions. First of all, in Four Lions, the app they use, I think it's called Puffin Party.
Oh, yeah.
That's how they communicate. It's like this little children's app, and they have these puffin avatars where they send these terrorist messages to each other. And then Simon Pegg's out of order sign that's hung around his neck.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the winner is when one of the robots somehow, like when they're dismantled, they're like legs attached to arms, so it's like this running robot with these kicking legs, like for arms.
Very good. What about you, Phil?
His punches have the power of kicks.
Yes.
I am going for the grid in the Quiet Earth because Thanos didn't go far enough, if you ask me, given the state of the world. So getting rid of everyone except three people.
That's good.
Oh my gosh,
that's part of that, right?
Phil, our Facebook page is gone now. As soon as they hear this podcast. All right, that's fine.
That's true. Sorry.
Now that you've called for the extinction of the planet, yeah. But you didn't say the K word. We're probably okay. I'm going to go with the use of dismembered robot arms as weapons as they started smashing the robots with their own arms.
Arms.
Yeah, yeah. Well armed. So your favorite name, Phil, of these characters?
I went for Claude, which was the fake name that Omar gave Hassan. Or possibly Wadge.
Wadge is a pretty cool name.
What about you, John?
It's short for something, but I can't work out what.
Yeah, it's a weird. Yeah, Wadge. It's a great nickname, though. My names are... I didn't realize this. I did not even realize this until I just looked at all the names right in a row. But the five names are King, Knightley, Prince, Chamberlain, and Page.
You're right.
Which, I'm like, huh. Oh, what? Yeah, and so, the king's in charge, and then there's a knight, and a prince, and a chamberlain, and a page. It's Pete Page, Ollie Chamberlain, Steve Prince, Andy Knightley, and Gary King. Yeah.
Doggone it.
So, Ty, is that what you picked?
These films are so packed with detail.
That's not what I picked. I picked Becky Salt.
Becky Salt.
Becky Salt.
That's good.
Is also...
But even that is... And they're called Salt... Their surname's not Salt... Leek and Bacon or something. The marmalade sandwich curls.
Oh, yeah.
I was trying to work out what that meant, but I'm pretty sure their surnames were Salt, Leek, and Bacon.
All right. Sounds good. So, Phil, did you say yours?
Claude,
that's right. Okay. Yeah. All right, then, John, your favorite food?
My favorite food is... Okay, honorable mention to Andy's wedding ring, which I thought was just... Have to point out the scene that's something so sexy. Like, if I were married and this hot girl came up to me and took my ring off and ate it, I'd be like, okay, I'm yours now, I guess. but I went with the champagne with an egg in it. I guess it's probably what Rocky drinks in the morning.
I don't know.
Again, from Drinker's Corner, I can say some people sort of put a raw egg in various hangover cures, but champagne and a raw egg, that's nothing else. I've never heard of that. That's very odd.
It's weird.
All right, Phil, what about you, Phil?
I went for the pub chips that they eat in the World's End. Just because they look so bad, and that's what makes them look so good.
So from the quiet earth, I went with breakfast in bed with a side of Hinders. All right.
Hinders.
Hinders. Okay, favorite outfit, Phil.
Dead heat between Wadge's costume for the London Marathon. That's, the bird ostrich kind of outfit is just a perennial slapstick favorite. And RP's leather trousers and earring from the quiet.
Oh, man, that's so good.
Oh.
What do you got, John?
I have the name tag only on Zach when he's naked, except he's wearing his name tag.
So I just went with Zach's nightie. I mean, it looks pretty comfy. So, and the added benefit, we get to see his nipples through it, so that's pretty good. Mm. All right, who's your favorite alien then, John?
I have Zach at the end of The Quiet Earth, where he's an alien to the Saturn-like
good
planet.
One.
Oh, wow, very good.
Good one.
What about you, Phil?
I missed that one on my list, so I will say the same.
So usually we make a racist remark about who's not American, but this category...
It feels very inappropriate.
Yeah. Okay.
So Barry. Barry's the alien.
Barry's the alien.
Yeah.
Very good. I went with the blanks from The World's End because they're the literal aliens.
They're from another planet. Or somewhere.
Yeah, so
they're from space.
Best special effects. I'm just going to say it first in case one of you guys steals it, so I can feel a little bit good about myself. Mm-hmm. So Saturn rising over the horizon of wherever he's at, and just that whole scene. Lovely.
Oh, I should have said that. I didn't say that, actually. I went with Martin Freeman with half of his head gone, but still talking.
Yeah, that's really good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Similarly, I went for the effect whenever they sort of splatter ahead of one of the empties.
Oh, yeah.
I watch them in slow motion. It's really hard to see the join between real actor and exploding blue ink head.
All right. How about your favorite location, Phil?
Sheffield, which is a place I lived in for not too long, but I did live there and I still have family there. And that was where Four Lions was set. So I'm very attached to the trams and the skylines of Sheffield.
So filmed on location then?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. Filmed fully on location in Sheffield and London.
So when you're watching it, you're like, I've been there, sort of.
No.
No. Okay.
No, all right. I hadn't been to those particular neighborhoods, shall we say.
Ah, okay.
But I recognize the trams.
Okay. John, what about you? Favorite location?
Okay, so interestingly enough, a lot of New Zealand has changed because I finally zoomed in on the map he was looking at, and I'm like, okay, where in New Zealand is he? Is it somewhere I'd been? And it was like, oh, he was in Hamilton, New Zealand, where I spent 10 months. and I didn't recognize anywhere, but I think, I'm not sure, but I think when once Oppie comes along and they go to like the wood carving place, the Maori Marae, you know, where's the wood carved cabin, and they all stay together. I think they're in a place I've never been in New Zealand called Rotorua, which is, you know, where the hot pots are. It's kind of like the Yellowstone that exists in New Zealand. There's like kind of like a park there, and there's like a lot of pretty things, and it smells funny because there are like a lot of geysers and springs and stuff, you know, like Yellowstone, but it's also heavily Maori area, so I think that's where they went, and it's lovely.
Oh, cool. Nice. So I don't know if my answer is the same. I kind of went with the fancy planet all to yourself, I guess. So I guess I'm saying New Zealand, right?
Yeah. If you're going to be trapped on a planet by yourself, I think New Zealand is the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, not bad. Okay, your favorite song, John.
Okay, this will be big. Okay, honorable mention to This Corrosion by the Sisters of Mercy. It's a great needle drop, you know. It has a strong beginning that kind of gets you pumped in the rest of the movie. But I think my favorite song of the ones I heard is probably Fool's Gold by Stone Roses, which is played early in The World's End.
Solid choice.
Very good. What about you, Phil?
Yeah, the entire World's End soundtrack. But if I had to pick one... Happy Hour by the House Martins, which comes on immediately at the very end. And I just think it really works, you know, as on that very final scene when Gary lunges forward in the post-apocalyptic wasteland in support of his robot friends, and it cuts into Happy Hour. It's just like the end of Hot Fuzz, where they go into Caught by the Fuzz by Supergrass. Just the perfect song for the moment. Mm. And I've been in bands that have performed covers of Happy Hour, so I have to choose that.
Very good. So my honorable mention goes to Zach when he's playing the sexy saxophone. The Quiet Earth. So my pick, it's one of my... So John and I, we do our annual Halloween mixtape, and This Corrosion is one of my very favorites that we've ever slapped on there. So that was fun.
It's good.
Yeah, okay, your favorite guest, Phil.
Sorry, what does guest mean in this context?
Who knows? We really have no idea. We think maybe it's someone who we haven't seen on any movie in one of our podcasts before, or maybe someone who possibly is famous from another line of work. It's kind of whatever you want. Did you like someone, but you don't have another award for them? Yeah. Slap it down here. So,
How about I didn't like Benedict Cumberbatch.
Okay,
and it's interesting to see him flail in an early role where he's not the star.
Okay, so the award is everyone but Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
Okay.
How about you, John?
Okay, I'm going with Pierce Brosnan. I think, and I don't know if this is just this is just a dumb little joke, but Timothy Dalton was in the last Cornetto movie. And so then they get Pierce Brosnan for this one. So I'm not sure if that's just a kind of a cheeky little, hey, we got the next James Bond in the next Cornetto movie.
That's funny. So my honorable mention is Pompidou's butler as Malcolm Storage. Probably going to watch some Pompidou tonight now. But I went with Namdor the Relentless playing Waj.
I knew you were going to do that.
Yeah.
Kayvon Novak?
Yeah, I think that's his name.
Kayvon, yeah.
Okay.
He's a really good guy, yeah.
Well, Phil, what's your favorite Odyssey reference here?
Well, I'm going to consult my little clip I made of the Odyssey's Wikipedia entry earlier.
Okay.
The sun god insisted that Zeus punish men for this sacrilege. They suffered a shipwreck, and all but Odysseus drowned. Odysseus clung to a fig tree. So, clearly, the quiet earth having one person survive until the others show up is clearly a reference to this episode from the Odyssey, where only Odysseus survives by clinging to a fig tree.
Mm. Wow.
Very heavy-handed. And speaking of fig tree, right, like Adam covered his nakedness with a fig leaf in the biblical story, and
Zach didn't Zach bother has, to do that.
Yeah, he didn't bother. Fig leaf's gone.
Okay, don't take mine.
Okay, go, John.
My Odyssey reference is that when Zach is naked on the bed, he covers himself in using the sheet in a toga-like fashion, one that might be used by one Odysseus in ye old times.
Yeah, so obvious now you say it.
Yeah,
it's pretty heavy-handed, right? So I'm just going to say that the Golden Mile is the Odyssey. Gary King is Odysseus. This is his journey. He cannot come back home until he completes this journey.
Oh.
Subtle. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. External recurring character, John.
Okay, my external... I'm looking for it. I'm going with Nick Frost, who was in the other Cornetto movies when we watched Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead.
Okay.
He was in this one, but he was playing the straight man, which is...
Yeah.
Interesting
choice.
So
we never mentioned that.
Right? Yeah.
Like, Simon Pegg kind of plays the irresponsible character, and Nick Frost is the straight guy.
Yeah. Which, good job, Nick Frost.
Yeah. All right, Phil, do you have an external recurring character?
This was another one that I had trouble remembering exactly the concept behind it.
Oh, well, since you're supposed to remember every movie we've ever talked about on this podcast. Yeah, and then pick a character from one of these films or an actor that appeared in one of those. So,
well, I'm sure something. Martin Freeman has been in something you've been in.
Martin Freeman, was he in Hot Fuzz?
Yes, very briefly at the start.
He was in Shaun of the Dead, too.
And he was in Shaun of the Dead, so there you go.
Yeah.
So
I could finish this trio by saying Simon Pegg, but I think I'm just going to go with Cornetto.
Nice.
Internal recurring character. There actually is a couple. Phil, are you aware of any actors that worked on more than one of these films that we just did?
Yes, although I went more meta and went for the actual or hoped for End of Civilization.
Okay.
That's
good. Oh, very good. Yeah.
Which happens literally in two of them, and that's what the characters are working towards in the third one.
Yeah, very good. What do you got, John?
Okay, I'm going to choose one of them. And the actor is Darren Boyd, and he was the bully, Shane Hawkins, in The World's End. And he was a sniper. Yes, he was a sniper in Four Lions. Yep.
Okay. I also chose that. But what was the other one? Do you remember?
The other one was... I don't remember what it was. The thing is, it said there was overlap, but I couldn't find it listed. Like, I click on the person's name, and it didn't show, like, what he was for Four Lions, so... I'm thinking it was like a special thanks or something. It wasn't important enough to actually show on his acting page, so it must have been something else, but I can't remember what it was.
So did you have Kevin Eldon and Matt Stone that supposedly appeared in both?
Oh, it's not Matt Stone. He's like Matt Stone and Trey Parker, the South Park guys. Yeah.
So it has him as music. Like, he worked on music, I guess, for both films. Kevin Eldon apparently acted in both in it, but I have no idea. But I had chosen the same one you did.
Okay,
your favorite death?
Brother Crow.
Oh, yeah, the crow, the poor crow. Oh. What about you, John?
Gary's mom finally died, kind of off-screen. They just kind of casually said it. It was an excuse earlier, and it's like, oh, by the way, mom died.
So our own CIA lied to us because Osama bin Laden died during Four Lions.
That's true. That should be our favorite death.
That's right. Cry. Oh, I read about that. Yeah, because they killed Osama bin Laden. I think I read that Osama bin Laden literally was killed like within a week of the movie's release, like either before or after.
It was pretty close. It was summer 2011, wasn't it? And this came out in November 2010, so it was
Okay, yeah.
Do you
think he had an opportunity to have a laugh over this movie before he died?
I mean, if I say I hope so, is that good or bad?
I don't know. I have no idea. Okay, who's the best villain? What's the best villain, Phil?
I'm going to say Omar.
Okay.
Because he ultimately, he lies to Wadge.
Yeah.
Earlier on, he says to Fessel, it has to be your choice. He's quite stern on that. And then later on, he says to Wadge, who he's closer to than Fessel. He does the whole heart-brain trick on him, and Wadge knows it's wrong, and he manipulates him into doing it, which he shouldn't have done, and then regrets it too late, and then absolutely needlessly, once everything else is lost, goes into a chemist and kills more people for absolutely no reason. So he's a villain in my book.
Very good. John, what do you got?
Man's free will.
So I just went with bombs. Bombs. But so that's those are the villains. Who's our hero, John?
Let's see. I put honorable mention to Steve in The World's End because he brings the car and he gets the girl in the end. He gets Rosamund Pike.
Yeah. Which is nice.
Yeah, but the true hero is the network, the intergalactic network that's similar to Star Trek's Federation, you know, where they go around organizing worlds into better places. But those places don't want that kind of organization.
Hmm. Okay, so I got lost in thought. Phil, have you done your hero?
I went for Brother Crow again.
Yeah, very good. So I went with Andy. I'm sorry. I feel like he's the one that maybe tried to turn his life around in the intervening years, and they kind of danced around like some big trauma that happened. But it turns out that he, you know, his life really isn't together. But you know, he's trying to not drink, but when it comes down to brass tacks, he steps up and he can deliver on the action. And so I wondered, right, like if he could complete the Golden Mile because he didn't drink all those beers, but I think those shots probably caught him up. So
yeah, good for
anyway,
him.
Anyway, congratulations, Andy, on giving up on not drinking.
He caught up to drinking so fast, like within like 10 seconds.
All right. What's the best movie goof, John?
Okay, at the beginning of The World's End, I've said this word several times in this podcast, controversy. But at the beginning of The World's End, a character clearly states controversy, which, that was a goof.
All right, what about you, Phil?
Controversy. I would say it's... again, I'm going to bring the beer drinker's perspective. In his last book, Two Pub, it looks like he's pouring himself Foster's, which if everyone else is dead and you can have anything in the world, you would never have Foster's in a million years. It's just awful.
It's Australian for beer, right?
Oh, don't. It's not really Australian. Don't blame them for that. And then in the last but one pub, he has Cronenberg, when he could have had a Foster's right next to it, which makes sense because Cronenberg's better, but that just makes you think, why did he have Foster's in the last one? Mm. And then in the final pub in The World's End, he pours himself a cask beer, which is, you know, so completely different from keg lagers. So it was all over the shop. His beer choices were just making no sense at all.
Must have been product placement.
Quite possibly, yes. I recognize a lot of them.
Mm. Okay. So when Peter is fighting in the bathroom, he gets set paint on the back of his outfit. Like, I guess they just finished painting the set and it was still drying, and he gets paint on the back of his outfit. Like, he rubs up against one of the urinals, and for briefly you can see paint on the back of his jacket or whatever he's wearing. Yeah. All right, the funniest moment, Phil. What's the funniest moment in these films?
Tricky, and it's like just a classic old-fashioned slapstick moment, but there are rocket propelled grenade misfire. Can't go wrong with a bit of slapstick.
What do you got, John?
Okay, when Gary is trying to impress Rosamund Pike on the roof, and she's like, "We got to get down to the car." He's like, I've got a better idea. And he jumps off the roof and just demolishes himself and the car. Like falling on it.
Okay. So I have the Waj making the video with the tiny AK-47. Like it's like
proper replica, man. Big hands. Yeah.
Just got big hands. Yeah. It's really good. Also, Faisal showing that he covered up his face when pretending to be a girl. That's pretty good.
When I honorable mention to, he's like, oh, no, I bought all this stuff. I use different voices. One of my voices was a, did he say, an IRA voice?
Yeah, they're terrorists, Faisal.
All right, so your best WTF moment there. Actually, there's a quite literal one in World's End, but Phil.
Well, yeah, there's two candidates, and they're both quite obvious. One is the robot reveal in World's End, where the movie turns on a dime.
And that's where the WTF is literally set at that time.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And the last shot of Quiet Earth. Where you're like, what?
Yes.
Now we're on another planet? Didn't see that coming.
What do you got, John?
This is the end of the movie Quiet Earth memorial list, where I don't say the Quiet Earth because, you know, of course that's the right answer, so I'm going to say something else. I'm actually going to go... Actually, the end of all three movies, I was kind of like, WTF? Because even, like, the end of Four Lions, I'm like, oh, okay, they all exploded and I don't know how to feel. But I specifically want to go with the end of The World's End, where I'm not sure what Gary became. Like, am I glad he's not drinking and he's given up drinking for marauding across the countryside? and I'm still sort of confused on that. But I guess that's what you do when you overcome something. You replace it with something else.
Okay. So I chose when Faisal blows up, which is weird because you absolutely see it coming. But when it happened, it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
There's that. Best quote. I'm going to go first. I don't think anyone's going to choose this one, but I better safe than sorry. So from The Quiet Earth, after they park the truck outside the area where he can, you know, he says, you can't bring it any closer. It's too dangerous, right? It'll explode. And then... Carla Weathers and the girl, they're enjoying each other's company, and then so Zach gets in the truck and he's driving it towards the base, and so he did, you know, obviously he was lying, but the quote coming from Carla Weathers is, he tells lies.
Yeah. And it was
just like the delivery and the line was just so so anyway,
yeah, that's that.
Anyway, what do you got, Phil?
I've got from when they're planning to bomb the mosque and Faisal is worrying about his dad who goes to the mosque. And Barry says, has your dad ever eaten a Jaffa orange? He's buying nukes for Israel. Which kind of exposes the extremist, literally extremist mindset. Yeah. and this modern generalized reduction of debate to absurd extremes that we all must plant ourselves behind one extreme or the other.
So that just feels like today's social media is like that, right? Like if
exactly.
I want to post on Twitter that, hey, I really like eating Nutella straight out of the jar, like I should expect to get a comment saying, why are you supporting child sex slavery, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Alright, John, your favorite quote.
My favorite quote, just a quick one from Four Lions near the beginning, when the two coworkers are talking and the one guy talks about how he's doing leg day and Lefty just wants it more, and before you know it, you're running in curves because his left leg is so much more powerful than his right, so he's running in curves.
It demands more from him. Okay, very good. What's your favorite scene, John? The best scene?
Best scene. I'm going to have to go with bathroom robots in World's End.
What about you, Phil?
I'm going to go for the no beer spill fight in World's End, where Gary is desperate not to waste a drop. And that reminded me of a bit of the bit in the Four Lions where they're trying to carry the explosives. Carry them quickly but gently.
Yeah.
It's the same with the pint in the fight, and drinkers will be used to that, whether in a mosh pit or on even ground at a music festival or a crowded bar. We all learn the way to hold your pint so that you can go in a zen state of calm to preserve every drop.
All right. So I chose from Four Lions the I don't know what I'm doing scene with Waj. I thought that was a pretty good scene. And then that segs right in my best actor, who is Kaven Novak as Waj. And Phil, who do you have?
I'd probably go with Nigel Lindsay, who's just utterly convincing as Barry and hilarious.
Okay, he was good. I probably should have picked him. I went with Rosamund Pike because I'm just bad at telling when someone's acting well. But I liked her for like her wide eyes and how she always got lost when she drove.
All right. So it's time to offer an unanswered question, and here's the one that I have. How can I sleep at night knowing that Gary did not drink the final pint? Like, how dare they not let him get that final pint?
I'd never even noticed that. My God, I can't believe I hadn't noticed that. You're right, he doesn't, does he?
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Maybe that's why he's not drinking anymore, because he's like, I'll have the final pint later.
Yeah.
And so he's like saving that final pint for later. Yeah.
He's forged a new life for himself without having to fall back on that. Good for him.
So, and I understand that he's a complete alcoholic, but like I was really rooting for him to finish that 12th pint. So, all right, well, what's your unanswered question, Phil?
Where is Zach, and or should we be laughing at Four Lions?
Oh, okay. Oh, very good. Zach's in hell. Should we be laughing at Four Lions? Absolutely.
No, we shouldn't be laughing at Four Lions, which makes it such a compelling movie because it's so funny. But we shouldn't laugh. But I laughed.
John, so where's Zach, John?
Oh, crap. Zach is... I say that is Saturn.
He's on Saturn, seeing Saturn?
He's seeing Saturn, yeah.
He's seeing Saturn rise from Saturn.
Yeah, it's a big mirror. It's a mirror okay. on Saturn. Yeah.
Okay. All right. What's your unanswered question, John?
Okay, okay, I have two quick questions. First of all, there's a sign in the town in the World's End where it says it's England's first roundabout. Is it really?
No, surely not.
Okay.
It's a fictional town, but it was filmed in one town. But I think it was a new town, so no, it couldn't possibly be.
Okay, good. Okay, also, one of the things I think... I can't. If it was Barry or like the conservative cousin who said something about, "Hey, we have to fight because, you know, pretty soon, you know, women are going to be speaking in public, and you know, we're going to be eating pork, and people are playing stringed instruments." and I was wondering, is stringed instruments something? Is that against like Orthodox Muslim law?
I don't know. It could be like those things in Leviticus, you know, like mixed fabrics and shellfish and all that
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, but I'm kind of surprised. Stringed instruments are a bad thing. Okay, those are all my questions.
Oh, very good. Now it's time to get personal, and we are going to project onto Phil the most Phil scene. And I think I'm just going to go with the frustration of the gang from the World's End when they go to the second pub and it's identical to the first as the Phil-est scene. So, John, what do you think?
I'm going to go with the final confrontation between Simon Pegg and Nick Frost when he's like, "This is what I have. This is the only thing I have left, so I'm going to finish it."
Okay. Well, Phil, what do you think? What is the fillest scene of these three movies?
Of those two, John has much the more bleak view of my existence. So I would say it's probably the former. I have high pub standards.
There you go. I win. Okay, so
good.
Phyllis character. I went with Andy. I don't really have a good basis for that.
Glasses? But the glasses?
Interesting.
The glasses, yeah. And not
I don't wear glasses.
You know if you wear glasses. What are you talking about, bro? So anyway,
I feel like you're
a responsible guy, but you can get stuff done. You can get it done. So that's
bar stools.
Yeah, you can. I bet in a bar fight you could hold your own pretty good. So all right, John, thanks. What do you think?
I went with Oppie. Because like you know how to drive a truck through another truck. And the leather pants.
Very good. All right, so Phil, what's the Phyllis character?
Well, I feel like I'm letting you down, John, to say I have nothing in common with Oppie whatsoever.
Oh, man.
Okay. So go ahead.
The Phyllis character is Gary King, because I'm very nostalgic. I've got arrested development. I long for days gone by, and I idolize the past.
Is your mercy tattoo? Four robot companions in the form of high school chums.
Well, yeah, that too.
Nice.
All right. So this is Phil. You don't have to speak here, but I'm guessing the Phyllis movie is The World's End.
It's,
John.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so you can. So now we're at that point where we'll find out, right?
Yeah.
So, Phil, of these three films that you gave us to watch, what is your third favorite?
Quiet Earth, but I love it.
Okay. Very good. John, what do you think?
I'm picking Quiet Earth. No. I'm picking Four Lions, but just because I have an excuse, because I said I had problems with it, and that's just my excuse for putting it third, because I had a hard time deciding what goes third.
So I had Four Lions as third, and I switched it. So I'm going to go ahead and put The World's End as my number three.
Oh.
And then I'm going to wrap around with Four Lions. John, what's your number two?
Oh, wow. I'm going The Quiet Earth as number two. It didn't go to the places... It would have been number one, but it didn't visit the specific homes of New Zealand that I visited. So I'm like,
that's really disappointing for you.
Yeah.
They really let you down.
Yeah.
Yeah, geez. All right, Phil, what's your number two?
Four Lions.
Four Lions. And your number one then
is World's
The World's End. John,
worrying reasons, it strikes a chord with me.
I like The World's End. I think it's kind of funny because, well, Four Lions did this too, but I had my problems with it. And The Quiet Earth, had its depth. World's End, I think it did have depth, and it made me laugh the hardest too. Although, did I laugh? Yeah, it's neck and neck as far as humor, but it also had the weird depth that's almost as depthy as The Quiet Earth too. So I don't know. World's End is good.
Okay, well, we all guessed right for Phil. But so my favorite was The Quiet Earth. I really like The Quiet Earth.
Nice.
Good.
There you go. All right. So, folks, that is it. But it's time to talk about the indentured servitude of Phil, who must return in 2 weeks as we discuss music theory is what John calls this category. For a while.
Yeah.
Mostly biopics. I thought we were going to get a non-biopic, as for a while, I Want to Hold Your Hand was right up there.
I still got the DVD from the library, so I'm going to watch it anyway.
Yeah. So our fans, or whatever you want to call them on Facebook, they have decided by one vote. This was a well-voted poll, by the way, so thank you, everybody. We are going to go to the movie theater and watch Respect.
Wow. I hope that's available in your... Okay, actually, Phil, how available are you to go to the theater?
I don't know is the short answer. I will have to look into that, but I will find a way if possible.
Okay, well, we'll...
steal a car.
Steal a car, maybe steal the movie. I think, the worldwide pandemic is fine if you want to... I mean, I don't want to say it on live air, but I'm sure you have sources if necessary.
Okay.
All right. Well, Phil, you get to choose a film. So what would you like us to watch for this category?
And are we allowed biopics, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Musicals, especially. Yeah.
Then I would like to watch Backbeat.
Backbeat?
Backbeat.
Whoa, that came out of nowhere. Okay, that wow. Got a couple votes on the polls, but okay. I've never seen Backbeat, but I remember when it came out.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. So I think there was a Saturday Night Live skit that made fun of it where Phil Hartman was the fifth Beatle.
Yeah, the tromboner of the Beatles.
The tromboner of the Beatles, yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. So I have a choice here. This is hard. The voting was really good. Get On Up got a lot of votes, and I would have liked to have seen that. We got several people who are probably going to hate me for not choosing La Bamba, but that is going to not be chosen. I Want to Hold Your Hand, man. I really would have liked to have watched that. There's a bunch here. Coal Miner's Daughter. I really wanted someone to pick that. But the one that I wish had been voted the most was Control. And I'm not picking it, but I may just watch it anyway. I've never seen it. So what I'm being guided by is that anytime you have an opportunity to watch a film where Gary Busey is the star.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're going to watch the Buddy Holly story.
That came out of nowhere. I went and rented Coal Miner's Daughter because I thought for sure that's the secret one you were keeping from us.
Oh, I would love... I almost picked it because I love the idea of watching the Loretta Lynn biopic, and it's Sissy Spacek, right, who plays it?
Yeah.
I bet it'd be really good, but man, we haven't had a chance to talk Gary Busey on this podcast, so we're overdue, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to learning all about him because it's one of those names that we know here as a very American legendary name, but I don't really know why he's such a big deal.
Well, so he's fascinating. So he was in he did this movie, which by the way, I want to say the Buddy Holly story is like 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, and a lot of the credit goes to his portrayal of Buddy Holly. But then he did several action films where he was the bad guy. Like, famously, he was in Lethal Weapon. Then he just kind of, like, went weird, like, real weird. And he just started ending up on a bunch of reality TV shows for, like, has-been actors. Mm-hmm. Like, he famously, what was that show called, John, where the show was just, like, some guy who wanted to be Gary Busey's friend? I'm with Busey. And they would go out into the wilderness, and Gary Busey would get really mad at him for not being man enough, and... It was weird. So that's
right. What, yeah. He seems like a punchline to a lot of jokes. In
yeah,
American
I think
culture.
He probably is. Yeah. So the next category, as far as like films that are gonna get picked, there's nothing to vote for. In 4 weeks, we're gonna talk to Shanthony Cortese, the Cortese brothers. So they're gonna give us three movies. So sometime in the next week. They'll reach out and let me know what they want to watch when it's their turn. And then the category after that, where we can start picking a category, is their community service. Randomly, what was chosen for their community service is category number 28, which is called Into the Wild. And it's just about, like, I guess think Jeremiah Johnson or... The movie about that guy who got his arm pinned by a boulder, but basically, like, someone who, like, for whatever reason, finds himself out alone in the wilderness. I guess Never Cry Wolf would fit, right?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Probably available on Disney right now.
Yeah, yeah. All right, John, give us a category.
Okay, category... I didn't realize how perfect this is, but the one that spoke to me this time is category 75, which is Twinners, which is movies about twins, or with twins in them.
Very good. Okay. So can you think of some? So there's twins, right?
Twins.
There's twins.
Both sets of Parent Traps.
Okay.
Dead well Ringers.
Okay.
Sisters,
go to triplets?
Oh, Three Identical Strangers. I think Three Identical Strangers would count. Let's say like more than two or more.
Sure.
Yeah, is totally fine. Three Identical Strangers would be great for this, I think.
Perfect.
And yeah, I think there wasn't there like an Annette Funicello movie where she doubled up.
Disney loved doing that for a while, didn't they? When they like discovered the Parent Trap technology.
Yeah, there's the Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin movie where it was two sets of twins that in one set got switched to birth, and so they thought they weren't identical twins, but then they met and they found out it's two sets of identical twins that were switched but were raised incorrectly.
Hmm. Oh, fascinating options. Now, Phil, what category have you got for us?
That's quite the ambush.
We're springing so much stuff on Phil this time.
Oh, did you not know you were choosing
no.
a category?
Do I have a list, or can I make up my own category?
We mailed you an itinerary. I don't know if it's reached the... Yeah. We post-dated it.
Yeah. By all means, you can make up your own category, whatever you want. We do have a list that I think we've shared with you in the past, but you are not bound to that.
Well, now I'm on the spot. I will go for... Oh my God, that's too much pressure. Let's say movies about... Orphans.
I like
it. I hate orphans. I hate all the orphans in all the world.
I hope that wins then.
We can watch Nacho Libre, yeah. So
orphan
perfect.
Movies. That's excellent.
In 6 weeks, we're either going to watch movies about wilderness people or twinners or movies about orphans. All fantastic choices. So
probably not orphans.
Yeah, stupid orphans. So, Cortese Brothers, congratulations. You're stuck with one of those three categories. So, but that is it. So, Bill, it's always a pleasure having you. Thank you so much for coming back, even though we ruined your life last time.
Great pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we ruined your whole week with this, with the timing and the scheduling and the missed days and everything. But, hey, it was fun for us. So, yeah, I hope you sleep it off tomorrow. It'll be just fine.
Yeah. Yep. And then in 2 weeks we'll do it again, and it'll be great.
Yeah.
So let us know if you're not going to be able to watch or respect, and we'll figure something out.
Yeah. I'm sure I'll find a way. Thank you very much, guys. It's always a pleasure. Been a lot of fun.
Yeah. So is there any endeavor that you're currently engaged in that you would like to plug? Because we have a vast audience.
Mm-hmm. No, other than to say, the Babylon 5 podcast will be fulfilled. It will be completed at some point, but I'm not promising when. Other than that, I am. My project is maintaining mental health, and you should too, listeners.
Very good. Hear, hear.
Yes.
All right, John, if people are listening to this podcast for the first time and have no idea what's going on, fill them in. What do they need to know?
Well, you ought to know by now if you're to this point in the podcast. But if not, I think the best place to go is if you go to the blog, it gives a little thing saying what we're about. And that's yours, mine, theirs, podcast.blogspot.com. That's one way to do it. If you don't want to do that, go to Facebook. Look up yours, mine, and theirs. And it's a Facebook group. And that also says what's going on. Also, that has the polls, and you can do the voting. So even if you're not listening right now, you can still vote and control our lives. And also, we have an email. It's yoursminetheirspodcast@gmail.com. Go ahead and send us an email. And I remembered the phone number. If you want to leave us a voicemail, call us at 801-896-4542. 801-896-4542. Go ahead and leave a message, and we will play it on the air. We might, and yeah, we'll only bleep out obscene, profane things. But otherwise, if you want to insult us, you insult us all you want by leaving a voicemail.
But at the end, like, concede that it's a 5-star podcast verbally.
Yeah.
But after that, you're good.
Yeah. And also physically stamp us a 5-star podcast on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are borrowed from, and then you can leave any kind of review you want. So go ahead, do that on iTunes. It's very vastly important that that's what you do. So I think that's all the contact stuff.
Awesome.
Well, hey, you two guys, thanks so much. I love doing this. Again, like, this is one of my favorite things that I still do, and it makes me happy, speaking of mental health. And
yeah.
I get to lock the door and keep those awful children out. I wish they were orphans, although that doesn't make sense, because I guess that means I'm dead or whatever, right?
Yeah, don't follow that thought.
Yeah,
okay, so...
You got
to. But, no, I love this podcast. I love talking to you, too. I can't wait to talk again in a couple weeks.
Yeah, no, it'll be great. Sounds good. Weeks. So, yeah, everybody stay great until then. Yeah, so looking forward to it.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
So what are you eating, John?
Salt and vinegar Pringles.
What color is the packet?
Blue?
Yeah, with Pringles it's blue here, but there's... Well, we might be coming on to British culture and arguments and pub discourse soon, but there's a huge kind of cliché debate in Britain as to whether... salt and vinegar should be in green packets or blue packets.
It feels like it should be green. Anyway.
That's... Yeah, they're always, I guess, across brand. They're in blue packets. I didn't even think about that.
Okay, I mean, you're probably just sitting on the toilet then, which is fine, right? Or nice. You've got, like, your stadium buddy strapped your leg or whatever. So.
Do you guys not record on the toilet?
So you'd have to go back and listen. I think we've got some sounds. So
yeah,
that's true. Actually, I remember years and years and years ago, I don't know why this sticks in my mind, but one of the quotes from you, Roy, I've no idea why I remember this one specifically, but I think John's in the middle of talking about a Star Trek episode or something, possibly the Dauphin, and he hears something that suggests you might be in the bathroom and challenges you on it. And your response is, John, when we get full of food, we poop it out.
I don't recall that.
That's the kind of class we exhibited.
I must have listened to hundreds of hours of your output. I don't know why that one quote sticks in my mind, but it does.
Oh, good.
It's funny that it does, because I'm sure that's something I would have removed.
Thank heavens you didn't.
It was on the end.
Normally, it could have been. Yeah, maybe it's the end one. So it's like, okay, I'm removing it and sticking it at the end. That's
funny.